into the law, which affects all of us. The new series of The Law Show with me, Dr. Joelle Grogan, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Wednesday afternoon at 3.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Monday, the 4th of November. Good morning. This is Today with Nick Robinson in Salford and Michelle Hussein in London.
Good morning. The headlines today. Sir Keir Starmer is pledging extra funding to stamp out people smuggling gangs who he says pose a threat to national security. We'll be speaking to the Home Secretary Yvette Cooper and the former Chief Immigration Officer for Ports. Donald Trump is alleging that Democrats want to steal the election as the US presidential election campaign enters its final day. We'll be hearing from Trump supporters who went to one of his rallies in Pennsylvania yesterday and the Democratic strategist Jim Messina, who ran Barack Obama's re-election campaign.
When I talk to both campaigns for my TV appearances, they both feel very strongly that the data says they're going to win. We haven't seen that sort of mismatch in the data since 2012.
Also on today's programme, the anger in flood-hit areas of Spain, 1 week on. The Prime Minister and the King and Queen have all faced hostile crowds.
The military came in 3 days after the disaster, and people feel like that was too late. Like, people feel like the military should have been here on day one from the very beginning.
And how this year's grape harvest in the south of England is being attacked by pigeons. We'll hear from a winemaker in Surrey. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The Prime Minister is to announce that an extra £75 million is to be spent on tackling what he'll call the national threat of gangs smuggling people across the Channel. Sir Keir Starmer will outline the details when he addresses the Interpol General Assembly in Glasgow today. The Conservatives said the extra funding would mean nothing unless migrants were deterred from making the journey. Our Home Editor Mark Easton reports from Glasgow.
30,000 people have crossed the Channel in small boats already this year, more than half of those since Labour came to power in July. The numbers emphasise the challenge the government has set itself to smash the smuggling gangs. Having ditched the Tories' plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda, it's pinning its hopes on domestic law enforcement and international cooperation. Most of the money announced by the Prime Minister today, around £60 million, will be spent on buying surveillance technology, covert cameras and other spy equipment to help UK police infiltrate and undermine the organised criminals.
Ahead of tomorrow's US presidential election, the candidates Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have been trying to woo voters in the small number of states which are most likely to decide who enters the White House. Polls suggest the result could be extremely close. Our North America editor Sarah Smith is following the campaign.
In this incredibly tight race, both candidates are frantically campaigning for every last vote. Donald Trump is already alleging that Democrats are trying to steal the election. He also told supporters at a rally in Georgia he was on course for victory.
So with your vote on Tuesday, we're going to fire Kamala and we are going to save America.
Kamala Harris has been harshly critical of Mr. Trump, but has now stopped mentioning his name, as she says she wants to end her campaign on an upbeat note.
We are optimistic and excited about what we can do together.
What has often been an angry and aggressive battle for the White House will end with them both holding competing rallies in the biggest swing state, Pennsylvania, later today.
King Felipe of Spain has said he understands the frustration of people affected by last week's deadly floods after he was pelted with mud when visiting Valencia. In a video posted online, the king said he guaranteed the state would do all it could to help. More than 200 people have died. From Valencia, Bethany Bell reports.
There have been further storms and more rain. The situation for rescue workers and the victims of last week's floods has become even more difficult. The sense of anger here is widespread. It boiled over in the town of Paiporta yesterday during a visit by Spain's king, queen and prime minister. They were heckled and had mud thrown at them. The police are using search dogs and drones to help locate people who might be trapped in hard-to-reach areas.
Moldova's pro-European president, Maia Sandu, has won a second term, defeating Alexander Stoyanoglo, who's backed by a pro-Russian socialist party. President Sandu thanked voters living outside their country, saying they'd saved Moldova from hostile foreign forces, a reference to alleged Russian election interference. Moscow denies this. There could be up to a quarter of a million more flats with flammable cladding across the UK than previously thought. The National Audit Office says that potentially more than 7,000 affected tower blocks haven't been identified and subjected to repair schemes. The government says it's formulating a plan to speed up cladding removal. But Richard Moore from the End Our Cladding Scandal campaign is angry about the way the crisis has been handled.
The idea that twice as many people just makes me angry, to be honest. And if you needed evidence, these figures support that evidence. It's a national scandal that is not getting the attention it deserves.
An Israeli court has said a leak of classified intelligence involving a close aide to the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, may have compromised efforts to secure the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas. The court said the adviser, Eliezer Feldstein, and three others were under investigation. Mr. Netanyahu has denied wrongdoing by his staff. The Queen's campaign against domestic abuse is the focus of a new ITV documentary. Her Majesty the Queen, behind closed doors, sees her speak with survivors of abuse. The Queen is calling for it to not be a taboo subject. The programme will be broadcast next Monday. Our culture reporter, Noor Nanji, has the details.
I don't know where you'd like to begin your story.
The Queen meeting Natalie, a victim of domestic abuse. The pair met as part of an ITV documentary aimed at tackling the problem. We see the Queen talking candidly to those who've experienced it and urging others to discuss the subject more openly. The Queen has been a long-standing campaigner against domestic abuse. She has previously warned of a pandemic of violence against women and has invited campaigners to Buckingham Palace. She also used her recent trip to Australia and Samoa to highlight the issue, calling on delegates at a Commonwealth summit to end domestic and sexual violence now and forever.
Noor Nanji reporting.
Caroline, thank you very much. It's 6 minutes past six. Helen Willits has this morning's weather. Hello, Helen.
Michelle, thank you very much. Hello there. Good morning. We've had a weekend largely devoid of sunshine, but it has been dry. That trend of dry and rather cloudy weather will continue on and off for the next few days with some subtle changes day to day. Across England and Wales then for the detail this morning. It's mild and temperatures will rise through the day to between 12 and 14 degrees Celsius, 14 where we do see some brightness, and that's most likely across the southeast of England because we've an east-southeasterly breeze, or perhaps in sheltered parts of southwest England and West Wales. But we do have a little bit of mist and fog, a few pockets of fog to clear this morning, and that of course at this time of year, November time, does take its time. Gentle breezes today, but the breeze increasing as the week goes on does promise the chance of a little bit more brightness. For Northern Ireland, because it will be predominantly cloudy here today, a blanket of cloud continues with us, 12 or 13 the high, and possibly that cloud thick enough for the odd spot of drizzle. The odd spot can't be ruled out across eastern England either, but it's more likely across eastern parts of Northern Ireland today. Finally to Scotland, where it's starting chilly this morning across a Boyne. Where we've had the chilly start, we will have the sunny skies. That's where we'll see the best of the sunshine, northern Scotland today. But again, there's just an awful lot of cloud around. And that cloud, particularly near the northern and western coast and the northern and western Isles, just thick enough to give the odd spot a drizzle at times. Temperatures between 10 or 11 in the cloud, 13 in that sunshine. I'll have more through the morning.
Helen, thank you. A warm bonfire night beckons. Time for a look at the morning papers now. What's on the news websites? A number of the papers focus on the final day of campaigning in the US presidential election. Harris and Trump make final push in swing states is the Guardian's headline. The paper says the Guardian, the candidates are trying to sway wavering voters on the eve of a deeply polarised election. The pair are returning to Pennsylvania today. Well, the paper says recent polling has suggested Mr. Trump has made progress. The Telegraph says the former president went off script during a rally in the state yesterday, describing the Democratic Party as demonic. The FT says his campaign has been even darker than in 2016 and 2020.
The I says Russia could try to whip up militant action by Mr. Trump's supporters if he loses. It reports that diplomats are warning hostile state actors will seize the opportunity to spread disinformation and create instability.
The New York Times says foreign interference in American elections has become far more sophisticated and difficult to track. The paper warns that disinformation has matured into a consistent and pernicious threat, and that the ability to convince just a small number of Americans could have outsized consequences.
The Times leads with reporting of an article written for it by the businessman James Dyson, calling the budget spiteful. He writes that raising inheritance tax on farms and family businesses would be the death of entrepreneurship. The Telegraph focuses on the Chancellor's defence of her decision to end the inheritance tax exemption for farmers. Rachel Reeves said yesterday that the government couldn't afford to let the practice continue. The paper says the move will raise just £500 million a year, which it says would fund the NHS for one day and 5 hours.
A leader who knows how to get Britain's economy booming is the front page headline in the Daily Mail as it welcomes Kemi Badenoch to her new job. It says her first interview as Conservative Party leader created clear blue water with Labour by saying she would shake up the economy with an approach completely the opposite of that taken by Rachel Reeves.
The Times covers the Prime Minister's plans for tackling small boat crossings in the Channel. It says Sir Keir Starmer will double spending on the problem and will warn today that the world needs to wake up to the severity of the migration crisis. The Sun says it's already the deadliest year on record for small boat crossings.
The front pages of The Guardian, The Times and The Daily Telegraph all feature photographs of the King and Queen of Spain visiting areas devastated by last week's flash flooding. The royal couple are pictured splattered with mud after some angry residents pelted them. "You've abandoned us," is The Guardian's caption.
And The Star says people heading out to enjoy bonfires and fireworks this week have been told, not least by Helen Willits, that they can leave their hats and scarves at home. It says the Met Office has forecast 20 Celsius for London on Wednesday, which would break the date record for November the 6th.
The time is now 11 minutes past six.
Just one more day before Election Day in the United States. Our correspondent in Washington, Jess Parker, is watching those final appeals, and they are dark, we were just hearing, Jess. Dark warnings coming from Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump has made some interesting comments on Sunday, particularly at a rally in Pennsylvania. One that kind of caught the headlines is that he was looking at the bulletproof glass around him, and he said to somebody that a would-be assassin, he was suggesting, would have to shoot through the fake news, and I don't mind that so much. So those comments were picked up on. And then as well, talking about the end of his tenure after he left the White House in 2020, he talked about how he shouldn't have left. And following these remarks, his campaign sort of sought to clarify these things. They said on the shooting remarks it was nothing to do with the media being harmed and that he was actually looking out for their welfare. They're essentially sort of defending him against what they'd argue was misinterpretation. But I think some of these comments will build into this idea from his critics that there are further examples of violent rhetoric, election denialism. And I suppose the risk for him a little bit as well is it could take away from those core policy messages, which he does like to talk about in these rallies, such as on the economy or immigration and crime as well, issues that we know have cut through.
And the critics took a little bit of hope from a poll in Iowa over the weekend at a time when most of the polls are too tight to call.
Yeah, I mean, look, this race is still very unpredictable, still very tight. And I think, you know, it's interesting looking at the way the polls are playing out in terms of Kamala Harris looks like she's doing better with women, Trump looking like he's doing better with men. But there was this particularly interesting poll outside of the seven swing states. They're both holding rallies in Pennsylvania today, the kind of key swing states, as many see it. But outside of that, there was this poll in Iowa by somebody known as Ann Seltzer, a well-known pollster for the Des Moines Register. And in Iowa, Trump is, it's not really supposed to be a competitive state. He's won it the last two times, but it shows, and it is just one poll, but Harris with a slight lead on Trump. And this pollster saying that independents, older women seem to be breaking more for Kamala Harris. Donald Trump not pleased by this poll at all. He hit out at it, said it had been put out by one of his enemies. The farmers, he said, love me. Of course, a very agricultural state, and I love them. And I'm not down in Iowa, he said. And look, as I mentioned, it's one poll, but it does, I think, show that slightly frantic, fractious mood around this unpredictable race with such a short time to go now until Election Day, although, of course, a lot of people have already taken the opportunity to cast early ballots.
Jess Parker, thank you.
14 minutes past six. A National Audit Office report published today is raising the alarm about the number of buildings in England that still have dangerous cladding on them 7 years on from the Grenfell fire, and also about how long it will take to remove it all. Phil Hendry, BBC reporter, has done a lot of work on the cladding crisis. One of the striking things about this report, Phil, is the difference between the number of buildings already identified as having this cladding on them and the number the NAO think are affected.
Yes, indeed. It will probably come as quite a surprise to listeners that the number is so large. So currently in the government schemes that that taxpayers' money has been used to help fix, there's nearly 5,000 individual blocks of flats. But the NAO, for the first time, has published the Ministry of Housing's own internal estimate. Now, this has never been made public before for a number of reasons, which suggests that there could be in total up to 12,000 blocks of flats that have flammable cladding on them. Now, that's an additional 7,000 buildings. Potentially, that's around 250,000 flats across Britain that could still have flammable cladding that has yet to be identified.
And that, of course, will have implications for the cost of fixing it all. But the NAO report, it also has some really worrying details in it about how hard it is even to identify which material has been used on a particular building.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the Ministry of Housing has known this for a while, and this has obviously been made public by the report. It essentially comes down to the complexity of ownership. Listeners will be aware that many flats in this country are leasehold, therefore they're owned by a freeholder. In many cases, those freeholders are difficult to trace. When we're looking, when the Ministry of Housing is looking for who is responsible for all this, from the freeholder, they're also looking for who the developer is. Now, very often, the developers may have ceased trading, or indeed, once they've finished building the flats, they sell the freehold on to somebody. So there's a whole complex web, which is partly the result of the leasehold system in England and Wales, that it makes it very difficult to trace who's actually responsible. And if you have a developer and a freeholder involved in this, there's a blame game that can go on as to who should actually take responsibility for fixing the building.
We'll look at how this affects social housing in particular in another hour's time. Phil Hendry, thank you.
Time now is 16 minutes past six. Businessman and inventor Sir James Dyson has said that Rachel Reeves's budget is killing off family businesses and will be the death of entrepreneurship. Strong words from one of Britain's most successful entrepreneurs. How true might they be? Sean Farrington, take a look at that. The rest of the morning's business news. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Nick. Yeah, of course, he turned his bagless vacuum cleaner invention into a company employing 14,000 staff around the world, more than 3,000 here in the UK at the moment. One of the UK's richest men, worth more than £20 billion, it's reckoned. One of the biggest business leaders to back Brexit, of course, accused of hypocrisy when he moved his headquarters of Dyson, the global headquarters, to Singapore back in 2019. And interestingly, in this debate around the budget, he's reportedly one of the UK's biggest farmers as well, owning large amounts of land from Lincolnshire to Gloucestershire, his farming business employing more than 250 people here. So when Sir James Dyson talks of a spiteful budget hitting small businesses and startups, is that how those who are doing just that right now view it as well? Paul Taylor is the co-founder and chief executive of Thought Machine, which is a UK tech business in the financial sector, a fintech that was most recently valued at over £2 billion, so has had a bit of growth. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you agree? Does it feel like this is the death of entrepreneurship, or it will be this budget in the UK?
Well, I've just read the article, and I must say I completely agree. I don't think it's the death of it. I mean, that's too much. But he is right in saying that, in pointing out that the risks in taking a business are enormous. When you look at a large business and you see it being successful, you've just named all the facts and figures. But what you didn't say is, you know, in the early days, you know, how difficult it was. And when you read his book, he talks about how difficult it was for many, many years of bank loans. And for it's easy to look at a successful business and say, oh, look at that. But, you know, you have to look at how difficult it is. In the early years, It's critical. All these little things about tax breaks for investors, stock option tax breaks, and the general sentiment in the environment, employment law, which I'm not sure he mentions, all these are critical to the success of a business and having that really, really rich startup culture that makes it easier for business. Only entrepreneurs can make businesses, right? It can't be done by government, but by having a friendly environment, a friendly playing field, it really makes it easier. And every one of these measures, none of these measures on their own is the end of the world, but it just all stacks up and it all tips the scales against anybody starting a new business.
So for something like the financial services sector, the tech business behind that, which is one of those industries that gets talked about with our industrial strategy, with attempts to get investment from around the world into those kind of sectors here in the UK. Does it feel to you like overall that the industry is going to be held back now, or can it kick on as many hope it would?
Well, as an entrepreneur, you regularly face impossible odds. So no one's ever going to give up and no one's going to say that's the end of it. What I will say is when Thought Machine started, so Thought Machine's a fintech based in London. I got about 500 people, operates internationally. When we started in 2014, I would say we had by far the best startup environment in Europe. Now, one budget from there hasn't killed it all, but gradually entrepreneurs' relief has been taken away. There's been multiple, anti-business legislation. We have the employers' rights from day one coming in. The national insurance bill is £800,000 for us, completely unexpected. For example, we are a licensed business, right? So I've heard previous guests on your program who come from catering and hospitality say what a struggle they face about whether they're going to pass it on to the customers in the low-margin industry. But we set our prices years in advance because we sell licenses. So we can't pass it on to our customers. It all has to come from some internal source. So, you know, and we agonize about how to spend our budget, and we think we do it very, very well. And then to be, to have a slice taken out of it like that, it's very, very painful. Now, we also operate internationally, and that means we sell internationally, but we have people internationally. And so this will not really affect our business in terms of the ultimate success of sales or our growth or things like that. Mm-hmm. We'll do very well. But where we locate our people, it will have a big impact.
And just finally, Paul, when you look at everything in the round, as Rachel Reeves was trying to make this case in the interview she was doing yesterday, saying that when everything is considered, the spending, the added borrowing for investment, everything like that, this will be good, to quote, good for employment growth and wages growth.
I don't think so. I mean, I'm an engineer, not an economist. But if you raise taxes, you take demand out of the economy. And what we most need, I think everybody needs, is growth. Growth should come first. Public spending should come second. So it's just at the top of every decision should be growth. And then and the growth is going to come from high growing companies. That's where it comes from. It doesn't come from the established companies, and it doesn't come from the public sector. So invest more to make the growing companies grow further. And that's where the growth will come from.
Paul Taylor, co-founder, chief executive of Thought Machine, that fintech business. Thank you very much. How are businesses, many of those small businesses, the family businesses that Sir James Dyson talked about in his piece today, how are they actually starting to act in the immediate days after the budget? A company that looks at this kind of stuff is Kroll Financial and Risk Consultancy, which says that those in the hospitality, leisure and retail business is expected to feel the most pain, as Paul was alluding to a bit there. Sarah Raymond is a co-head of global restructuring at Kroll, joins me now. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning.
What have you seen businesses doing, asking about since Wednesday?
So I think businesses have, as we've heard from your previous guests, been looking at what the cost burden, the tax burden is going to be for them going into next year. So the national insurance hike, the minimum wage increase, and for the hospitality, leisure and retail sector particularly, the impact of the reduction in business relief, together with also the new rules of around employment. Mm. So these
Are they doing anything right now, do you see? Because, we heard these warnings before, we're hearing the warnings after, but actual sort of action needing to be taken a bit more urgently than it previously was?
Well, these impacts aren't going to happen until April next year. So what businesses will be doing now is looking as to what they can afford What does that mean for their margins? What does it mean for wage growth for their staff? So are they going to be able to factor in the annual increases that they had expected to be able to give to staff this year? They may also be tempering investment projects. So as your previous guest said, this will go to growth projects.
And do you think
scaling back,
sorry to interrupt you, when you see, you know, those kinds of things, that scaling back, do you also, given it's one of the things you crunch the numbers on very regularly, do you expect this to mean more insolvencies directly?
So we expect it to be in the small to medium-sized businesses that will be mostly impacted. Obviously, the micro businesses have been cushioned to some extent with the increase in the employment allowance. But those small to medium owner-managed businesses will feel the impact more than the larger corporates, who will have the ability to absorb costs because they're likely to have more access to funding or reserves.
I wonder, there's been, you know, many storms weathered by these businesses in recent years. But would you expect this budget to mean now some of those businesses will be going bust, and more wood than you would have expected before the budget, or not?
We expect to see an increase in distress, definitely, across the hospitality, leisure and retail sectors, particularly next year, and in that small to medium-sized sector. So businesses will be planning ahead. We think there will be an uptick in insolvencies, in administrations where businesses are sold, and therefore there's likely to be more consolidation across sectors. And then we will probably see an increase in liquidations, which is where effectively a company, the business, ceases to trade.
Yeah, no buyer can be found, nothing can be broken.
No buyer, all that exactly. Kind
of thing. Sarah, thank you. Sarah Raymond there, co-head of global restructuring at the financial risk consultancy firm Kroll. Jane Foley, head of FX strategy at Rabobank. Jane, morning.
Good morning.
How's all that, you know, everything that Paul and Sarah talk about, particularly those things Sarah talks about, expectations of the economy in the near future, playing into, you know, expectations of the UK economy now? Has that changed since the government announced its budget?
Well, it has changed. I mean, we had the forecast from the Office of Budgetary Responsibility telling us their new forecasts, and that is a little bit more growth in the next 2 years, but then, you know, not so much in the last years of this parliament. It is possible that some of the measures will bear fruit into the next government, but of course we don't know who's going to win that election. But we do get the Bank of England, their new forecasts later this week on Thursday, and I think the market's going to be watching those pretty closely to see what the bank thinks in terms of the inflation and the growth impact.
Talking of elections, can I ask you how investors are viewing the US election at the moment? Just seeing this morning that US dollar weakening a bit. Is that anything to do with changing in thoughts of who might be in charge there?
No, it certainly is, because the market had been looking at the betting odds for the US election, and the betting odds had been saying that Trump was more likely to win. But of course, some of those polls, or some of those betting odds, I should say, have been undermined recently. But also the latest opinion polls, particularly the one in Iowa, is saying actually Trump might lose and Harris may win Iowa. And on the back of that, the market's been thinking, oh, maybe we were too hasty putting on those Trump trades. And those Trump trades suggested a firmer dollar because his policies with tariffs and tax cuts could be more inflationary.
Meanwhile, US jobs not sort of as strong as people might have thought.
No. So this was the data released on Friday for October, and only a small number of jobs were added, about 12,000. But the market was able to look through this to some extent because we had big strikes, for instance, in Boeing and also in the auto sector. And also, of course, the impact of those hurricanes earlier on in the month. So
right.
It's difficult to know exactly what this data really means. But I think we can probably conclude that the labour market in the US is slowing, but it's still relatively well supported.
Jane, thank you. Jane Foley, Head of FX Strategy at Rabobank. I'll be back after seven, having a bit more of a closer look at what might happen with interest rates and the Bank of England a little later this week.
Sean, thank you very much. It is 28 minutes past six, and the sport is with Kathy Nanasegram. Morning, Kathy.
Morning. Thank you very much. Despite an enthusiastic celebration from Ruud van Nistelrooy when Manchester United scored against Chelsea, their lead didn't last long, and the game finished as a 1-1 draw in the Premier League. Chelsea are in fourth place, but it remains United's worst start to a Premier League campaign, with just 12 points from their opening 10 games. Captain and goalscorer Bruno Fernandes feels there is, though, a different energy at the club, with van Nistelrooy in interim charge.
He feels it is the same way as he was playing still. He gives that energy to the players. He gives that that little push that we're needing at the moment to get the best out of ourselves, because we know that everyone's being a little bit disappointing with everything that happened with Eric, and we don't want to keep going that way. We want to improve things and do it differently.
Dominic Solanke scored twice as Tottenham came from behind to beat Aston Villa and move up to seventh place in the Premier League table. Villa are one place above them. Holders Rangers beat Motherwell 2-1 to secure their place in the Scottish League Cup final against Celtic. And Manchester City are top of the Women's Super League. They had a 3-0 win over Crystal Palace. Chelsea women are in second place after making it 5 wins out of 5 at the start of the season, with a 5-0 win over Everton. All of the day's results, including the first round of the Men's and Women's FA Cups, are on the BBC Sport website. It was a difficult race in wet conditions in Brazil, but Max Verstappen climbed up from 17th place on the grid to win Formula One's Sao Paulo Grand Prix, while the British driver Lando Norris started on pole and ended up in 6th place. Harry Benjamin has the details.
Max Verstappen now has one hand on his fourth world championship after a brilliant victory in wet conditions in Sao Paulo. He finished ahead of the two Alpine drivers in a shock double podium for Esteban Ocon and Pierre Gasly. Lando Norris falls 62 points behind now in the driver's title fight, with a 2-week break till Las Vegas, Verstappen's first opportunity to take the title.
After England had a narrow 24 points to 22 defeat to New Zealand in Rugby Union's Autumn Nations series, they've called up 20-year-old Asha Opoku-Fojo to the squad for their game against Australia to replace Joe Marler, who's announced his retirement from international rugby. And at the season-ending WTA tennis finals taking place in Saudi Arabia for the first time, despite some criticism, Iga Świątek beat the Wimbledon champion Barbora Krejcikova, and Coco Gauff defeated her doubles partner Jessica Pegula in the round-robin matches on day two.
Kathy, thank you.
I'm Danny Robbins, and things are starting to get even stranger in our trilogy of uncanny specials.
This was so beyond the realm of anything that I had ever experienced.
Episode 1 features the comedian and writer Stuart Lee.
Crossing the road walked a huge black dog. It turned to stare at him with eyes like saucers.
And then we take our first steps into a brand new investigation at Meadow Cottage.
In the corner, this thing just started laughing. It was eerie.
Listen to Uncanny on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The time is just after 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in Salford, Michelle Hussein in London, Caroline Nichols reading the news.
The Prime Minister is pledging more money to help tackle small boat crossings. Sir Keir Starmer will outline the details when he addresses the Interpol General Assembly in Glasgow today, in what he'll call the national threat of gangs smuggling people across the Channel. The extra £75 million in funding will be used for high-tech surveillance equipment and 100 specialist investigators. The Conservatives say the extra boost would mean nothing unless migrants are deterred from making the journey. The US presidential candidates Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have been trying to woo voters in swing states before tomorrow's election. More than 75 million people have already voted. Donald Trump said he would cut inflation and immigration when speaking at a rally in Georgia, while Kamala Harris pledged to do everything in her power to end the war in Gaza while she was in Michigan. Moldova's pro-European president Maia Sandu has won a second term. In a runoff election, she defeated Alexander Stoianoglo, who was backed by the pro-Russian Socialist Party. President Sandu thanked voters living outside the country, saying they'd saved Moldova from hostile foreign forces, a reference to alleged Russian election interference. Moscow denies any meddling. Up to a quarter of a million more flats across the UK could have highly flammable cladding installed than previously thought. The National Audit Office says that potentially more than 7,000 affected tower blocks haven't been identified and subjected to repair schemes. A leak of military intelligence involving a close aide to Benjamin Netanyahu could have hindered the release of hostages being held by Hamas. According to an Israeli court, the adviser, Eliezer Feldstein, and three others were under investigation. Mr. Netanyahu has denied wrongdoing by his staff. NHS England is encouraging people experiencing the first signs of a stroke to not delay calling 999. Analysis of calls made in the past year showed, on average, people waited 90 minutes to do so. Doctors say stroke symptoms, such as struggling to smile or raise an arm, may not appear dramatic, but are always a reason to act quickly.
Caroline, thank you very much. The time is 27 minutes to 7. The government is pledging millions of pounds today towards stopping small boat crossings. But having scrapped the Conservatives' Rwanda plan, will their approach stop the boats? Mark Easton is the BBC's home editor. Mark, what will this new funding pay for?
Well, yes, it's a sort of new £75 million already announced some time ago last month that they were going to spend on the Border Security Command. Another £75 million going to be announced today. £60 million of that is going to be spent on surveillance technology for the National Crime Agency. So that's going to be covert cameras, marine drones, other spy equipment, all very James Bond, which they're going to hope is going to help the police infiltrate and undermine the organised smuggling gangs. But actually, quite a lot of the money, that some of it's been already being announced, some of it new today, is going to be buying people. It's going to be buying specialist investigators for the police. And also, interestingly, beefing up the Crown Prosecution Service. Of course, Keir Starmer, a former director of public prosecutions, very keen to work with other authorities in other countries, using our prosecutors to help them bring people to justice, and vice versa. So looking to try and create new alliances in the prosecution space as well as in the police space.
And is there independent expert evidence that suggests this kind of approach is going to be enough not only to disrupt people trafficking here and there, but actually bring the boat crossings to an end?
Well, that, I suppose, is the million-dollar question, really. We know that the Tories regard the Rwanda plan as a gimmick. They've ditched that, and they're pinning their hopes on domestic law enforcement, but with a twist, in as much as they want to beef it up to the point where we use terrorist-style legislation, that legislation yet to go through the House of Commons and come into force. But that they want to introduce sort of legislation similar to the kind of legislation we use in countering terrorism to deal with these gangs. And as I say, they're also pinning their hopes on a much more international approach to this. So the Prime Minister and indeed the Home Secretary are here in Glasgow, where I am this morning, at the Interpol General Assembly. 195, can you believe it, countries and states represented here in Glasgow. And there'll be a lot of work going on to try and have conversations with people from around the world, right along the length of the migrant journey, as they describe it. So, as the Prime Minister will say today, from the money markets of Kabul to the beaches of Kent, and actually beyond that, he'll also be looking at a large number of migrants these days coming from Vietnam. They'll be wanting to create new alliances there too. So a really important day for the UK to build these alliances and have these conversations. And also, as far as the Prime Minister's concerned, to say to the global policing community, actually, this is a huge threat to global stability, and we need to be putting a lot more effort into it.
We'll hear from the Home Secretary at 10 past 8. Mark, thank you.
23 minutes to 7 now. The new leader of the Conservative Party has said that her approach will be, and I quote, the complete opposite of Labour's. Business, not government, she said, will lead to the revival of the country. It all means things could be rather different when we see Kemi Badenoch face Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions this Wednesday. Watching carefully as ever will be our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman. The gap between the big parties, back to something like it used to be, Henry.
I think that's right, Nick. I mean, one of the clearest divides between Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick in the final stage of the Conservative leadership election was on policy, in the sense that he had lots of it and she made a point of not having very much of it. She didn't campaign on policies. She thought that was unwise at this stage, so long before a general election. And she really campaigned on values and a promise to tell the public, as she says, the truth. And one of the values that she campaigned on was that the state needs to do less. She wasn't completely specific about where, but she said under her, the state would do less. And contrast that with the budget that Rachel Reeves announced just a few days before Kemi Badenoch was announced as the Conservative Party's leader. And you do, I think, as you say, have a very clear divide between the two main parties, which is going to be the divide of the next several years in British politics.
She now has to find some people to sit on the Tory front bench, which is going to be more of a struggle than it perhaps was when they were in government.
I think this is a really underappreciated point. A front bench isn't just a shadow cabinet, which is 20 or so people. It is somebody shadowing every single government minister, usually, which will take you to about 80 people. Well, that would be two-thirds of the Conservative Parliamentary Party, which is now just 121 MPs. So I'm told that Kemi Badenoch's appointments, which she will begin making today and then announce in full with a shadow cabinet meeting for the first time tomorrow, now, I'm told they're going to be conciliatory, with a job offer most people expect of significant prominence for Robert Jenrick and perhaps some of her other defeated rivals. But partly it will be conciliatory of necessity, because Kemi Badenoch could fill the shadow front bench with the 42 MPs who voted for her in the final MP stage of voting, and should still have half of a front bench to fill. But we do know, I think, some of the names who are closest to her. There are people who most people outside of SW1 won't have heard of, but are really close to her. People like Alex Burghardt and Julia Lopez. They were both, with Kemi Badenoch, members of the very small group of Conservative MPs who were first elected at the 2017 general election, and they've been close since then. And then there are also some people who've been a bit more prominent in recent years who backed Kemi Badenoch and people expect could be in line for big jobs. People like Laura Trott, the former Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Claire Coutinho, the former Energy Secretary, and Andrew Griffith, who did various ministerial jobs and is currently the Shadow Science Secretary.
Henry, thank you very much indeed.
It is 20 to 7. There are pictures in the papers today of the Spanish Queen with mud stains on her face. Not an accident, but the way that a royal visit to the flood-hit region around Valencia that went very wrong. Evidence of anger and desperation a week on from the first torrential rains. Bethany Bell, our Europe correspondent, is in Valencia now. How would you explain the way that anger turned on the King and Queen in this way yesterday, Bethany?
The anger among victims of these floodings has been growing. Everybody I have spoken to in recent days, really the sense of simmering anger was there. And that overflowed yesterday in the little town of Paiporta, which was particularly badly hit. Dozens of people were killed in that town. When we visited, we saw dead bodies being removed from the streets. And when the King and Queen arrived with Spain's Prime Minister, they were pelted with mud. There were people shouting at them, saying murderers. One young man said that it was well known that this was an area prone to flash flooding. Why hadn't action been taken to deal with that beforehand? The King later issued a statement saying that he understood the anger of the people and that he would do, that they would do everything they could to help them. And he called these floods a monumental disaster.
Were the authorities late to respond? Quite apart from, I know, the lack of warning or the lack of preparation is one issue, but even in the response to the disaster?
The authorities are out in force. We have seen over the last few days how streets are slowly being cleared. There are bulldozers out, there are teams of rescuers, underwater rescuers in some cases, as they go through underground garages and cellars looking for people who may have been trapped there. But many of the people we've met have just said they felt left alone. One woman said, who lives in Paiporta, described to me how she had been trapped in her apartment for 3 days after the flooding with no water, no electricity, and crucially no mobile phone signal, so she couldn't tell her mother she was safe. Electricity has been restored. They're working on the water supply now, but people here are feeling very desperate.
Bethany Bell in Valencia, thank you.
Turn now at 18 minutes to 7 to a quick look at the morning front pages. Dyson blasts spiteful budget is the headline in the Times. The paper's got an interview with Sir James Dyson, man of the vacuum cleaner, and much more besides, of course, who says, what is it about British families that Labour hates so much? He attacks what he labels a family death tax. What has upset him is not just that tax on people leaving farms to their children. Dyson's invested a lot in farms, but also something called business property relief from inheritance tax. He says, make no mistake, the very fabric of our economy is being ripped apart. No business can survive Rachel Reeves's 20% tax grab. And on the front page of the FT, it has it inside Trump's dark campaign, pointing out that much of the rhetoric has become very dark from the former president and the man who hopes to be president, accusing the Democrats of being demonic and fighting hard to steal this damn thing.
The picture of the Spanish Queen, Queen Letizia, on the front page of the Telegraph is really an extraordinary one because it shows her with her arms around someone who's clearly been very affected by the flooding, and she's sort of gripping her in her arms and the woman is in tears. But the Queen has clearly, I think, already been splattered with mud because you can see that on her face, and it's not the only paper which has those pictures on the front pages. Elsewhere, there's another aspect to the Duke of York and the housing situation, with him being forced, as the Mail was reporting yesterday, to give up Royal Lodge. But the Sun says that it looks like he's let his Windsor mansion go to ruin because there are pictures which show cracks and black mould on the exterior walls. And inside, The Guardian is a piece about Paul Stevenson, the civil rights campaigner known for his role in the Bristol bus boycott, who has died at the age of 87. Paul Stevenson played a pivotal role in rallying thousands of people for a 60-day boycott in Bristol in 1963 against the local bus company's refusal to hire black or Asian drivers. That contributed to the creation of the first Race Relations Act in Parliament. 2 years later, his children have said, ultimately, our father's legacy extends far beyond the awards and accolades he received. It is embodied in the lives he touched, the barriers he broke down, and the generations he inspired to fight for a more just and equitable world.
The Star raises a smile again with the news that it's going to be very warm this bonfire week. Here's a photograph of a guy sat in front of a roaring bonfire who is saying, the guy that is, not the bonfire, phew, is it me or is it very warm for this time of year?
Now, more than a month on from the Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon, targeted, Israel says, at Hezbollah, the impact on the civilian population is clear. Many areas are deserted, with people forced to move to try and avoid the fighting. Our correspondent Orla Guerin has been in Nabatea, which, before the war, was one of the most populated cities in southern Lebanon.
I'm standing in what is or was the old market area in Nabatea, the old souk. It dated from the Ottoman era. And now there's really just destruction in every direction. And over our heads, very loud, very low in the sky, an Israeli drone. It's been there for the past 10 or 15 minutes. And it continues to hover. I'm with Hussein Jaber from the Civil Defence in Nabatea. The drone is over us. You hear this all the time?
We hear it 90% of the time, but it depends exactly where it is. Now, we think it's right above us.
So they're watching us?
Most probably, yes. We don't care what they are watching. We care that we are here with our families and with every civilian in these difficult times.
Well, within the last few minutes, a patient has been rushed in, a woman. She's being treated here in the emergency department. You could hear now that she's in pain. She's a casualty of an airstrike that we heard just a few moments ago.
Where is it? That's not.
I'm on one of the hospital balconies now. There's just been another airstrike. I can see smoke rising in the distance just beyond the hill in front. We've been hearing planes in the sky.
We've had one or two other explosions in the past hour or so. Staff here at the hospital say the airstrikes can come at any moment, day or night. And a short time later, we heard this massive strike. The Israeli army says it's targeting Hezbollah, not the Lebanese people. We're inside the burns unit in the hospital. There are three patients here now, all victims of airstrikes. Lying in front of me is Mohammed, who's 29. He's a civil engineer. His injuries are very visible. He has severe burns to his face. He has bandages around his chest where he has third-degree burns. And he was injured trying to bring food to a neighbour.
The airstrike hit the house right beside us. It was very close, about 5 meters away. It was all black, smoke everywhere. I took like about 1 minute. Then I started to recognize what is around me. So my friends started talking to them and knew they were still alive.
And there was no warning before this strike?
No one. Not at all. Not to us, not to our neighbors, not to the person inside the house that was hit. No.
The area that was hit, was this completely a civilian area?
All civilians, yes. The person who died actually is a policeman.
We're driving through Nabatea now. Flattened, crushed buildings in every direction. Empty streets, boarded up shops, and almost no people. We've seen two people on the streets in the past hour. Everywhere there is broken glass, smashed shop fronts, rubble. It's been turned into a ghost city. And if and when people try to return, there'll be so much damage to repair.
Orla Guerin, who joins us now live from Beirut, having been in the south to bring us that peace. Orla, as you look back on the events of the last month, to what extent would you say Israel has been successful against Hezbollah in that period?
I think if we judge it by Israel's original aim, it still hasn't been successful. That aim was to stop Hezbollah's rocket fire across the border and to allow about 65,000 Israelis who had to leave their homes in the north of their country to allow them to return. Now, no doubt, Michelle, that Israel has decimated the top layers of Hezbollah. It has killed Hassan Nasrallah, the leader. It has killed most of the senior military commanders and really wiped out, or as Israel says, eliminated the military command structure. But what we see is that Hezbollah fighters in areas in the south are still able to fire rockets across the border. For example, just on Saturday, there was another rocket attack into Israel and 11 Israelis were killed. So if the war aim was to stop the rocket fire and get the Israelis back into their homes in the north, so far that is a failure. And in the meantime, enormous damage has been done to Lebanon with really an escalating cost. The UN is now saying that the humanitarian situation is worse than during the war, the last Israel-Lebanon war of 2006. And just to give a sense of how bad things are, according to the Lebanese health ministry, in the past 5 weeks or so since Israel invaded on the ground, about 2,200 people have been killed here. We've had villages along the border with the dividing line, I should say, with Israel completely wiped out. entire cities told to evacuate. More than a quarter of the Lebanese population is under evacuation orders from Israel. We have schools and universities being used as shelters. And really, for Lebanon, this has been a complete and utter crisis. And the fear is, when you speak to people here, that it will continue to get worse. They see what has happened in Gaza. They see that very much as a pattern that is being repeated here, albeit at a slower pace and so far at a lower level. But what they fear in the end is that Lebanon could become another Gaza. And the talk and rumour last week, the kind of speculations that a ceasefire might be in the offing, really seems to have faded away.
Orla, thank you very much.
It is now 7 minutes to seven. Graphene is one of the most extraordinary substances known to man. It's an atom thick and 200 times stronger than steel, and it was invented just down the road from where I'm broadcasting this morning at Manchester University. As if all that wasn't enough to impress, a new use for it has been found to help detect cancerous cells in the brain. Let's talk now to Professor Kostas Kostarellos, who is Professor of Nanomedicine at the University of Manchester. Morning to you. You're inserting graphene into patients' brains, I understand.
Good morning. Yes, we are interfacing what we call graphene-based neural devices with patients' brains, yes.
So in the brain, what's it doing?
So we're trying to understand the signals that neural cells that act as the host cells for patients' brain cancer, what kind of signals they are emitting, what kind of signals they are changing into as they are hosting the tumor cells, and in the context of a particular the particular intervention, we're trying to identify where exactly the tumor cells are in order to be removed.
I emphasise the strength and the thinness of graphene, but in a sense that's not the point in this case, is it? It's the fact that it's flexible and it can transmit electricity.
That is correct. The thinness also plays a role. So the novelty behind those devices are really standing on the shoulders of the fundamental properties that this material is offering in order to design and fabricate ultra-flexible devices that will conform to the anomalies and aberrations of the human brain, and at the same time offer us very high precision, very high fidelity signals from those neurons that are hosting the brain cells, the brain
and
cancer cells.
The precision matters because you can then just remove those cancerous cells rather than removing large parts of the brain. Is that right?
That's precisely right. Not even large parts, minute parts of the brain. You really do not have any room for error there. You really need to make sure you remove all of the cancer cells and leave behind all of the neurons, particularly those that are participating and contributing to essential functions for our patients.
When you talk of essential functions, do you think this could have an application for other diseases that affect the brain, strokes, epilepsy, those sorts of things?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the next phase in our clinical development. We are looking, first of all, to develop these devices for a precision, high precision removal of brain cancer, but because of the quality of the signals from the neurons that we are receiving, we believe we're going to be able to understand and maybe intervene in a much more precise way following stroke events and epileptic feats.
It's a fascinating example of how a discovery at a university can have implications that I suspect weren't dreamt of when graphene was discovered a few years back.
That's a good statement, I think, and you know, it gives me opportunity to talk a lot about our experience, which actually has been over 10 years long. And it's truly a collection of a truly international team that has resulted in this. And at the same time, as academics, we realized that we wouldn't be able to translate the findings and the properties that this material is offering into the clinic for our patients without contribution from commercial entities too.
Yeah, it's a tribute to the University of Manchester. Well, thank you very much indeed for telling us about it, Professor Kostas Kostarellos there.
It is coming up to 7 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this week on Radio 4.
What happens when at-home DNA tests reveal more than you bargained for?
My birth mum was still here. She's still alive.
Six new stories of reconnecting and rupturing families.
I just couldn't believe it. I had a sister, after all.
Lives upended and long-buried secrets.
I then wrote back and said, look, the ripples from this will be enormous. What do you want to do?
The new series of The Gift with me, Jenny Kleeman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starts this Wednesday morning at 9:30.
Time for the weather now. Shorts and T-shirts for Bonfire Night, Ellen Willis.
Not quite. Well, if you fancy, Nick. Certainly not for me. It'll be a bit chilly out there, despite the fact that we're talking about it being milder this week because we've got a southerly breeze picking up. I do think it will be dropping to around about 8 or 9 degrees through the evening as well. And that's where we pick up this morning, actually, across England and Wales. The high pressure's with us. We've got a lot of cloud and therefore it has been mild through the night for November. Temperatures will lift to between 12 and 14 degrees Celsius, possibly 15 when we see a little bit of sunshine. And we should in a few spots, but they'll be the exception rather than the rule. Possibly shelter parts of Western England and Wales and the southeast later on, because it's an east-southeasterly breeze that's picking up. Might be a little bit of mist or the odd pocket of fog as well, first thing to watch out for. Now, it's not altogether dry. There could be the odd spot of drizzle, but that's more likely across in Northern Ireland, across the eastern side of Northern Ireland, that wind carrying the cloud on shore and just thick enough to squeeze some drizzle out of it. 12 or 13 under the cloudy skies, but predominantly dry and predominantly cloudy today here. And it will be across Scotland. There are some exceptions. The north of Scotland, a Boyne, close to freezing, not quite freezing this morning. But the chilly start means we've had clear skies, meaning we are going to see sunshine through the day here. But elsewhere, again, the cloud will be thick enough at times along the coast for the odd spot of drizzle. But for most, dry, just cloudy. Temperatures 11 or 12.
Helen, thank you very much. You're listening to Today with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussein.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Monday the 4th of November. The headlines this morning, Sir Keir Starmer is pledging to stamp out people smuggling gangs who he says pose a threat to national security. Will the extra money for tackling those gangs make a difference? After the news, we'll speak to the former Chief Immigration Officer for Ports, and the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will be here in about an hour's time. Donald Trump has made accusations of election fraud at a rally in Pennsylvania. His supporters tell us what they made of it.
Great. Love, companionship, everybody was there for the same reason, for a good outturn on Tuesday. And I think God gave us our modern-day Moses to deliver us from these crooks.
And with both Trump and Harris campaigning as hard as they can, we'll hear from Justin in North Carolina, one of the seven states that will decide the election.
There is a nervousness among Republicans about whether they can get people sufficiently to the polls on the day. And there's just a sort of sense that there is quite a lot that could go wrong.
And at 10 to 8, we'll speak to the mother and stepfather of 15-year-old Holly Newton, who was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. They want the law to recognise that even those under 16 can be victims of domestic abuse. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
The Prime Minister is to announce an extra £75 million to be spent on tackling what he'll call the national threat of gangs smuggling people across the Channel. Sir Keir Starmer will emphasise the global challenge of illegal migration when he addresses the Interpol General Assembly in Glasgow today. The Conservatives said the extra funding would mean absolutely nothing unless there was also a deterrent to stop migrants making the dangerous journey. Our Home Editor Mark Easton reports from Glasgow.
30,000 people have crossed the Channel in small boats already this year, more than half of those since Labour came to power in July. The numbers emphasise the challenge the government has set itself to smash the smuggling gangs. Having ditched the Tories' plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda, it's pinning its hopes on domestic law enforcement and international cooperation. Around £60 million will be spent on buying surveillance technology, covert cameras and other spy equipment to help UK police infiltrate and undermine the organised criminals. The remainder is for specialist investigators and prosecutors. The arrival of representatives from 195 countries at the Interpol event held this year in Glasgow is also an opportunity for UK officials to discuss closer working relationships along the length of migrant journeys, from source countries to the beaches of Kent.
Ahead of tomorrow's US presidential election, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have been frantically trying to woo voters in the small number of states which are likely to decide who enters the White House. Polls suggest the result could be extremely close. Our North America editor Sarah Smith is following the campaign.
In this incredibly tight race, both candidates are frantically campaigning for every last vote. Donald Trump is already alleging that Democrats are trying to steal the election. He also told supporters at a rally in Georgia he was on course for victory.
So with your vote on Tuesday, we're going to fire Kamala and we are going to save America. We will cut your taxes, end inflation, slash your prices, raise your wages.
Kamala Harris has been harshly critical of Mr. Trump, but has now stopped mentioning his name as she says she wants to end her campaign on an upbeat note.
Our campaign is tapping into the ambitions, the aspirations, and the dreams of the American people because we are optimistic and excited about what we can do together.
What has often been an angry and aggressive battle for the White House will end with them both holding competing rallies in the biggest swing state, Pennsylvania, later today. Not every vote is still up for grabs. Early voting arrangements in many states mean over 76 million voters have already cast their ballots. That's almost half the total number of people who voted in the whole of the 2020 election.
King Felipe of Spain has said he understands the frustration of people affected by last week's deadly floods after he was pelted with mud when visiting the town of Paiporta. In a video posted online, the king said he guaranteed the state would do all it could to help. More than 200 people have died. From Valencia, Bethany Bell reports.
There have been further storms and more rain. The situation for rescue workers and the victims of last week's floods has become even more difficult. The sense of anger here is widespread. It boiled over in the town of Paiporta yesterday during a visit by Spain's king, queen and prime minister. They were heckled and had mud thrown at them. The search for people still missing in the Valencia region is continuing. The Spanish Civil Guard says it's deployed more staff. The police are using search dogs and drones to help locate people who might be trapped in hard-to-reach areas.
Moldova's pro-European president, Maia Sandu, has won a second term, defeating Alexander Stoianoglo, who's backed by the pro-Russian Socialist Party. President Sandu thanked voters living outside the country, saying they'd saved Moldova from hostile foreign forces, a reference to alleged Russian election interference. Moscow denies this, but the BBC's Vyacheslav Kromyenko, who's in the Moldovan capital, Kinishau, believes the result will be a blow to the Kremlin.
It's a strong political signal that Russia cannot control everything it wants to control, and that smart policy and strong measures against Russian meddling in elections, in the country's politics itself, can do a great job.
The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has said the concept of reparations for former colonial nations affected by slavery is not about money. It's his first comment on the issue since 56 Commonwealth leaders signed a joint letter last month, saying the time had come for a conversation about reparations for historic slavery. Mr. Lammy is visiting the Nigerian port city of Lagos during a tour of Africa. He told the BBC the solution was to deepen partnerships across the Commonwealth with trade, investment and growth.
It's not about the transfer of cash, particularly in a time of a cost of living crisis around much of the globe and certainly in the UK. That is not the debate I think that people are wanting to have. They're wanting to talk about the future.
The Conservative Party leader, Kemi Badenoch, has made the first appointments to her shadow cabinet. Dame Rebecca Harris will be the chief whip, whose job is to maintain party discipline. It's understood Nigel Huddleston and Lord Johnson will be the joint chairman of the Conservative Party. A new report says there could be up to 250,000 more flats with dangerous cladding than previously thought. A report from the National Audit Office says there could be more than 7,000 tower blocks still unidentified, which will be subject to the government's schemes to fix them. The NAO says it could be more than a decade before the cladding crisis discovered after the Grenfell Tower fire is solved. Phil Hendry has more details.
The report shows just how little has been done since the Grenfell tragedy 7 years ago to make flats safe. There are just under 5,000 blocks, the equivalent of more than 250,000 homes, currently known to the government. Only a third have had cladding replaced so far. Now it's been revealed that by the Ministry of Housing's own estimates, there could be more than 7,000 more blocks yet to be identified. The total repair bill could be more than £16 billion. The report says residents and flat owners still awaiting repairs continue to suffer what it calls significant financial and emotional distress. The government says it will come up with a plan to speed up repairs later this autumn.
NHS England is encouraging people experiencing the first signs of a stroke to not delay calling 999. After analysis of calls made in the last year showed on average people waited 90 minutes to do so. Doctors say stroke symptoms may not appear obvious or dramatic, but they're always a reason to act quickly. Our health reporter Philippa Roxby has the details.
Around 100,000 people have a stroke each year in the UK. The most common symptoms are struggling to smile or raise an arm or slurring words when speaking. NHS England says recognising any one of these signs in yourself or others and dialing 999 urgently is crucial to getting prompt specialist treatment. Yet the average time taken to make that emergency call was 88 minutes in 2023-24, NHS data reveals. The campaign's message is that without fast action, dying from a stroke or being left with long-term issues is far more likely.
Philippa Roxby reporting.
Caroline, thank you. It's now 9 minutes past seven. Keir Starmer has steered clear of Rishi Sunak's promise to stop the boats, but today he will use a speech at an international conference to promise to stamp out crossings, which he'll describe as a national security threat. How? Well, he says by investing in technology, investigators and prosecutors to help smash smuggling gangs. We'll hear more about that in about an hour's time from the Home Secretary. But will it do the job? Well, one of those who's pretty sceptical is Kevin Saunders, who used to be Chief Immigration Officer for Ports, part of UK Border Force. Morning to you, Mr. Saunders. Sceptical, why?
Good morning. None of this will actually stop the boats or stop the illegal migrants coming to the United Kingdom. Unfortunately, what the Prime Minister is trying to do is just not feasible. He's got to come up with a deterrent to make the migrants not want to come to the UK. If the migrants don't want to come to the UK, the smugglers won't be there to bring them.
Well, he says the deterrent is prosecuting those smugglers quickly, getting them sent to jail, a bit like happened after the riots in the summer, and deporting those people who come here who do not have their asylum claims granted and getting them out quickly. He says if you do all that quickly, that will act as a deterrent.
Well, it won't, because first of all, you can't deport failed asylum seekers because the majority of them destroy their documents. And so you have no document to remove them on. And what you have to do, you have to prove to the country that you are removing somebody to, that they are a citizen of that country. And the accepted way of doing that is with a passport. So if these people have destroyed their passports, then they give the Border Force an incorrect name, an incorrect date of birth. That's it. They're here for life.
But what about the deterrence against the people smugglers, which is if you use technology, if you have more investigators, you have more prosecutors, and you're able to therefore send to prison more of the gangs, maybe it sends a deterrent signal to them, which is it's not worth it. You're going to get caught.
Yep, you can send more of them to prison, but don't forget the only ones that you can actually prosecute and send to prison are the ones in the United Kingdom. And the majority of the people smugglers are actually based in the Middle East and in Turkey.
So you're wishing that the Rwanda scheme had not been killed, despite the fact that more Conservative Home Secretaries were sent to Rwanda than asylum seekers?
I think the Rwanda scheme deserved to be tried. I'm not saying that it would have definitely worked, but I think we should have tried it because nothing else is going to work. And with the Rwanda scheme, we already saw that the migrants in Calais were worried about that, and the numbers did go down slightly. But we also saw more migrants going to the Republic of Ireland and the Irish complaining about that because they didn't want to stand the chance of possibly being removed.
Isn't the biggest worry here that other countries simply don't see cross-channel illegal crossings as their problem, really? They've got other very big problems when it comes to migration. They've got their own political priorities and economic priorities, and sorting out what's happening on the channel comes very, very low on their list of concerns.
Yes, I'm afraid you're completely right there. And we have seen in Germany, even very recently, with the business about the boats, it is not illegal, apparently, under German law, to provide a boat that is going to leave the EU in an irregular manner. So it really does go to show that the Europeans are not completely on board with the Prime Minister.
Kevin Saunders, thank you very much indeed. We'll hear from Yvette Cooper in about an hour's time.
It is 14 minutes past seven now, and it's a week since torrential rain began in Valencia and kept falling. Images of flood-hit streets and cars washed away began to circulate, but we now know that at least 200 people were killed, some trapped in cars or homes amid rising waters. And evidence of how alone local people felt was clear to everyone when the Spanish King and Queen and the Prime Minister were shouted at yesterday, called murderers, and had mud thrown at them. Juan Bordera is an MP from one of the opposition parties in the regional parliament of Valencia and also a climate activist. Good morning, Mr. Bordera.
Good morning.
Tell us about what you had previously done and the way that I understand you had warned the regional government about risks associated with climate.
Yes, I'm the responsible of the environmental area in my party. So I'm as a climate journalist, as I worked as a journalist, tackling specifically this kind of events. We presented them a year ago, a specifically proposal called the increasing risk of floods in the Mediterranean, precisely because we knew that this was going to happen in some point. No? So we presented that evidence a year ago, and the last month, in October, we presented them three times. More proposals, another question to all the parliament, and an address, and another one addresses specifically to the responsible of the environmental area in the government, talking about this, talking about the increasing events because of the climate change, because we have in the Mediterranean, as you know, we have like a almost closed sea. So we have rising temperatures, record levels. We have atmospheric concentration of CO2 and atmospheric temperature way beyond record levels. So we know that the combination of factors
did you warn that people would die? People could die?
Well, we didn't tell this with these words, but it's one of the obvious consequences of these floods, of this kind of events. And the worst part is that the warnings were not only ours. We warned them because we are trying to precisely address this kind of issues of climate change. But the Spanish National Meteorological Agency, which is the AEMET, warned the government of the regional government of Valencia, warned them 10 hours before they did anything. So the responsible of the tragedy is, the first responsible is the regional government, with any doubts, and then we can speak about other responsibles and the justified anger that the people showed yesterday.
When you presented that warning yourselves within the parliamentary system and put it to the regional government more than once, as you've detailed, what did they say in response?
They laughed. The first proposal, the 1 year ago proposal, they voted against the proposal that specifically tackled the increasing risk of floods in the Mediterranean. They voted against.
On what basis? What did they say? They don't believe it, or it's too expensive to protect against it?
No, one of the two parties in the government that they are not they are trying to sell the image that they are not together right now, but they were. And when that proposal came, and they voted against because one of the two parties, it's climate denial party. It's extreme right, climate denials, and so if you deny the reality, you can think that there's a need to prepare. So that's the main reason. And the other one is not so specifically climate denial party. It's a business party. They are too worried to. They have too many worries about promoting tourism in Spain and big businesses. Our president, Carlos Mazón, was promoting tourism when the alarms arrived from the IMET, from the National Spanish Meteorological Agency. And he was trying to sell business, sell tourism in a time that the people need to be warned about that flood coming in hours, no? When the flood arrived and the people get their messages in the phones, they were returning from their jobs.
Juan Bordera, thank you very much.
It's 18 minutes past seven. The man who invented the bagless vacuum cleaner and a host of other clever electrical devices, Sir James Dyson, has said that Rachel Reeves's budget is killing off family businesses like his and will be, in his words in an article in the Times, the death of entrepreneurship. Well, Sean, what's upset him so much?
Well, strong words. A lot to do, Nick, with the inheritance tax changes that came out of the budget on farms as well. Reportedly one of the biggest landowners in the UK. So he has big views on that as well. Family businesses leaving assets over £1 million will now be charged 20% from 2026. There's this new 20% tax on farms worth more than £1 million, therefore. And so when you look at his description of the budget there and see how other businesses are reacting, that issue is one aspect of it. But as we heard an hour ago, it's not perhaps just one individual policy concerning so many business owners. It's the total of tax changes, wage increases, contractual cost increases, altogether that one tech boss we spoke to in the financial services sector said raised concerns for him. An insolvency expert telling me the number of companies in distress expected to rise because of the budget. Meanwhile, the Bank of England has got a decision to make this Thursday on interest rates and has to take into account longer term the new way our economy is set to work. Michael Saunders is senior advisor at Oxford Economics and member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee for 6 years up until 2022. Morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Does the budget change what will happen to the base rate of the Bank of England this week and beyond?
No, I don't think it does. The budget means that public spending will grow roughly in line with the economy in the next 2 years and the tax burden will rise significantly. The net effect of that will be to dampen growth in the next couple of years. At the same time, inflation has undershot the Bank of England's forecasts recently. Growth has been modest. Pay growth is slowing. I think it's very likely that they will cut rates by a quarter point this week. And they'll probably cut rates significantly further over the next year.
What are the big risks, do you think, from the budget now that you know the detail?
Well, the previous risk before the budget was that the public finances were not on a sustainable path. Deficits were likely to stay high and the public spending plans were, frankly, implausible. Now, this budget has significant tax rises and gets the public finances onto a sustainable path. And I think the Bank of England will welcome the fact that the outlook for public borrowing is now clearly lower. The risk is probably that growth will disappoint over the next couple of years. The budget measures in protecting investment will help the economy's long-run growth, and I think that's very important. But in the near term, the rising tax burden will dampen activity, and that's the reason why the Bank of England is likely to cut interest rates both this week and over the coming year.
When you say long-run growth and the investment plans would help that at first glance doesn't tally with what those numbers we saw from the Office for Budget Responsibility about what might happen to growth years down the line. Why do you sort of say something a little bit differently there, or is it different?
Dash, I think the OBR's analysis on this is completely right. Public investment is highly important in driving the economy's long-term growth. But it takes more than a five-year horizon, which is what politicians usually think of, for those full benefits to come through. And that's why so often over recent decades, whenever governments have had to act to reduce public borrowing, the first thing they've done is to cut public investment, because their judgment is, well, any costs will be in the long term, well after their own concerns. But of course, the effect of that has been to dampen growth, dampen the economy's potential for growth over time, and leave the UK economy stuck in as a slow growth economy with low public investment compared to other countries.
Right.
So I do welcome the fact that this budget acts to protect public investment, because that's really important for the economy's long-run growth performance.
Michael.
But at the same time, if you're acting to get borrowing lower, you can't avoid the fact that growth will be slower because of rising taxes in the next year or two.
Michael Saunders, Senior Advisor at Oxford Economics, formerly the Bank of England, thank you very much.
22 minutes past seven now. Thank you very much, Sean. All is not well with the process of removing dangerous cladding from buildings. Anyone who lives in one will tell you that, despite it being 7 years on from the Grenfell fire. But the National Audit Office has a stark report out on the subject today, pointing out that as many as 12,000 buildings in England could be affected, and also the immense complexity of even pinpointing which they are and who is responsible. There are complex ownership structures, they say. Trying to trace the developers is hard. Sometimes freeholds have been sold on, sometimes building materials are different to what was listed. Ruth Davison is Chief Executive of the Islington and Shoreditch Housing Association. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
How many properties within the association that you own are in this category of over 11 metres or higher?
So we're a really small association, but if you build homes in London, land prices are such that you build tall buildings. And for us, we've got 82 buildings above 11 metres. But unlike, you know, this report is about access to public funds to make homes safe. We are clear what buildings we have responsibility for. But unlike the private sector, the social housing sector cannot access taxpayers' money to make the homes of social renters safe.
But that should be a last resort. You should in the first place be chasing the developers, right?
We should be in the first place chasing the developers. So the government, the last government who made the rules around access to the scheme, had a pledge that you would be able to call on to remediate homes that they got big developers to sign. They said that they would have a second pledge for smaller kind of SME builders. They never put that in place. So if you're a small and medium-sized association such as ours, there are builders who never signed a pledge with the government to make homes
so
safe.
You would have used the smaller and medium-sized builders
yes,
generally?
Yes, of course. Yeah, no, we only own about 2,500 homes. And there are associations of our size in London and elsewhere where we have no access to developers to make the homes safe, and we've got no access to a government fund. And when I tell people that the only people who are barred from accessing government funds are social renters with a social landlord, the very people impacted by the Grenfell fire, they're incredulous. They don't believe it because it's so manifestly unjust.
But just explain exactly what's happening. So when you approach the builders who've built your housing blocks, your housing association towers, they say, sorry, there's no, we're not committed to, we're not required to be part of this. So you're on your own.
So a couple of developers were ashamed by the state of the blocks that they'd handed to us, and they stepped forward and they put them right. Others we have had to drag, kicking and screaming, at the risk of litigation to make those buildings safe.
And
but there are some who don't exist anymore. So we have one building where the developer went bankrupt, and it's not far from my home. It looks like a single building. We have 36 homes inside the bit that we own. The other bit has been owner-occupied since the day it was built. Those people have full access to government funds to make their building safe, and we have none. We've
so
just
hang on,
had
in
to
that
spend,
building, are you
yes.
saying the cladding is being removed and one half of the building is being made safe?
No, both halves of the building are being made safe.
But you're paying
But we've
one
had
half.
To pay £2.8 million plus VAT. Don't even get me started on why we have to pay VAT, as it's like rubbing salt into the wounds. But, you know, we're a small association. We've existed for 90 years. And our board took the really difficult decision just a couple of years ago to start selling social homes in London to fund making homes safe that we had paid for once and that were inspected by independent people. It's like going to a car garage, buying a brand new car, being really, really, really precautious and taking a car engineer to check, only to find later that the brakes are faulty, the hazard warning lights are not there, you know, and we are having to pick up the tab. The government now could act to change the rules and allow us access to those funds. And that would be a more appropriate thing to do. And actually institute that polluter pays principle, which they said, the last government said that they would, start a levy.
Ruth Davison from the Islington and Shoreditch Housing Association. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Time now is 28 minutes past seven. The next Prime Minister of this country could be Kemi Badenoch. Now, that might seem unlikely after the battering the Tories took at the election, but the Conservatives are now ahead of Labour in some recent polls, and politics is much more volatile than it once was. So the early decisions of the new leader of the Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch, who will face Keir Starmer at question time this week, do, or at least really could, matter. Let's talk about them with the deputy editor of Conservative Home, influential website read by Conservative members and activists, Henry Hill. Morning to you, Henry. We've had a couple of appointments to her new shadow cabinet already this morning. Now, I think these and all of the appointments will not be household names, but can you, someone who studies all this, make anything of the pattern that we're seeing already?
So what Kemi Badenoch said during her leadership contest, was party unity. That was her big message. And so when she's appointing people, she has two things to bear in mind. The first is she doesn't have that many MPs to choose from. The Conservative Parliamentary Party is actually at this point so small that it's going to be, even if all of them were willing to serve and not all of them are, she'd have to have some of them doubling up just to fill all of the shadow positions. That's the first problem. The second problem is that because of that, whoever she appoints is going to have an enormous amount of influence de facto over her freedom of maneuver on policy, because she simply doesn't have the capacity to withstand many resignations. And she didn't really get elected on any policy positions.
Well, she has made two appointments already. We've got a guy called Nigel Huddleston, an MP and a member of the House of Lords, Lord Johnson, who are now the joint chairman of the Conservative Party. Do those two names tell you anything?
Not especially. They were just her supporters during the campaign. Rebecca Harris, okay. Chief Whip, same deal. These are people who supported her campaign.
So and the interesting question then, Henry, is will she reach out to what sometimes in the code is called the one nation, the left of the Tory party? Because she, by instinct, is a small state, low tax, anti-regulation, Brexiteer, not a one nation Tory. Do you think she will include those people?
She said that she will. She said that she'll offer a job to everyone who stood for the leadership, and that includes three One Nation MPs, Mel Stride, James Cleverly, Tom Dugatat. James Cleverly has said he won't serve, but the other two, they might do. She also, as I said, she doesn't really have much choice but to offer an olive branch to the One Nation wing. And the other thing is that to remember is that Kemi Badenoch, she was on the right compared to some of the other candidates, but I talked to some right-wing Tory MPs, and they were saying right from the start that she doesn't really have much of a track record of in practice of talking much about taxation or the size of the state or anything else before this contest. Her reputation as a right winger is mostly built on social issues, but no, she's going to have no choice but to build a broad church cabinet. And we will see that coming out over the next couple of days.
We will indeed. And then we'll see her take the stage, parliamentary stage, that is, when she walks the dispatch box and asks questions of Keir Starmer on Wednesday at 12 o'clock. Henry Hill, deputy editor of Conservative Home. Thank you.
The Sport Now with Cathy.
Morning. A few football headlines to start. Manchester United and Chelsea drew 1-1 yesterday. It is, though, still United's worst start to a Premier League campaign with just 12 points from their opening 10 games. Tottenham came from behind to beat Aston Villa 4-1. Holders Rangers beat Motherwell 2-1 to secure their place in the Scottish League Cup final against Celtic. And Manchester City are top of the Women's Super League. They had a 3-0 win over Crystal Palace. Now, Inverness Caledonian Thistle are bottom of the Scottish League One table after being docked 15 points and being placed in administration. administration. The club, which was formed 30 years ago, is trying to raise funds to survive. And the former chairman, Alan Savage, has returned to the club to help with that funding. And we can speak to him now. Morning, Alan.
Morning.
Inverness Caledonian Thistle in a precarious position, obviously, from what I've just said. What is the current financial situation as far as you know?
Well, we're in administration and we've been in for a couple of weeks. It looks like we'll be in for another 10, 12 weeks or so. And the idea is to prepare the business for sale. That's what the administrators will do. And in the meantime, make sure we've got enough funds to run the club, which will amount to about 400,000 in that period.
What are the club or you doing to try and get that money, that funding? And is it a realistic plan, do you think?
Well, it is a realistic plan. I've put a lot of money in already and intend to keep the club going, commit our fixtures this season. We're trying to forge closer links with the fans and community. Already started some initiatives. Some businesses, local businesses are helping us. Tomatin Distillery in particular, Dog Falls Brewery and D&E Coaches. So there are people coming to the table and asking what they can do, especially the supporters. And if the community gets behind the club, we can get through this all.
Yeah, and it is community that's at the heart of this kind of situation, isn't it? The results is that Inverness Cali Thistle are bottom of Scottish League One, as I mentioned, on minus 2 points. What would it mean for Scottish football, but also for the areas that the club represents, if the club can't survive?
Well, I think it would be a very, very poor reflection on the Inverness community itself. Although the community had nothing to do with the state that the club's in, it's the former directors who've run the club into this precarious position. It would be bad for the fans, obviously, bad for the players, bad for the staff, bad for tourism. I don't think it would do Inverness any good. And I note that Lisa Nandy is campaigning or making mention of trying to look at football governance, but she never mentions Inverness, which is a bit disappointing.
It's one of those clubs that, I think everyone has a bit of an affinity to after that headline from, I think it's about 24 years ago, the Scottish Cup win over Celtic, Super Cali, Go Ballistic, Celtic are atrocious. Hopefully we'll speak to you with a bit more positive news in the future. Alan Savage, thank you for speaking to us this morning. Just a couple of other headlines for you. It was a difficult race in wet conditions in Brazil, but Max Verstappen climbed up from 17th place on the grid to win Formula One São Paulo Grand Prix. The British driver Lando Norris, though, started on pole and ended up in 6th place. And at the season-ending WTA finals taking place in Saudi Arabia, Iga Świątek beat the Wimbledon champion Barbora Krejcikova, and Coco Gauff defeated her doubles partner Jessica Pegula in the round-robin matches on day two.
Kathy, thank you.
What have we got?
On BBC iPlayer,
all I know is somebody's behind all this.
You can just walk away.
You should investigate. I got the
blues. These aren't crime dramas.
What the hell are you playing at?
They're a break from your work dramas.
How does all this make you feel?
Well done, everybody.
Dead and Buried, Line of Duty, Luther, and loads more.
We're throwing you a lifeline here, mate.
Whoever you are, whyever you stream, BBC iPlayer.
Quick look at the weather now. Mainly dry and cloudy for most, with just a few brighter spells developing in the west and far southeast later. A few light showers possible under the cloud, mainly in the north.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in Salford, Michelle Hussein in London, Caroline Nichols with the news.
The Prime Minister is to announce an extra £75 million to be spent on tackling what he'll call the national threat of gangs smuggling people across the Channel. Sir Keir Starmer will emphasise the global challenge of illegal migration when he addresses the Interpol General Assembly in Glasgow today. The Conservatives said the extra funding would mean nothing unless there was also a deterrent to stop migrants making the crossing. The US presidential candidates Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are in a final sprint to the line, with the election just a day away. They've been campaigning for every last vote at a series of rallies in key states. Donald Trump has alleged Democrats are trying to steal the election. Kamala Harris told supporters she had momentum and that she wanted to end her campaign on an upbeat note. More rain has hit the already flood-stricken city of Valencia in Spain. More than 200 people have died and others remain missing following last week's floods. King Felipe of Spain has said he understands the frustration of people affected after he and the Queen were pelted with mud when visiting the town of Paiporta. In a video posted online, the King said he guaranteed the state would do all it could to help. The cladding crisis has the potential to double in size across Britain. A report from the National Audit Office says there could be more than 7,000 tower blocks still unidentified and called for a target date to be set for completing the work. The government says it's formulating a plan to speed up cladding removal. The Foreign Secretary David Lammy has said the concept of reparations for former colonial nations affected by slavery is not about the transfer of cash. It's his first comment on the issue since 56 Commonwealth leaders signed a joint letter last month, saying the time had come for a conversation about reparations. Mr. Lammy is making his first visit to Africa since becoming Foreign Secretary.
Caroline, thank you very much. So one day to go until America votes, and with the two candidates focused on states likely to decide the outcome, Kamala Harris has been in Michigan, Donald Trump in Pennsylvania. And at his latest rally there, he has made accusations again of election fraud. Our correspondent Tom Bateman was there.
This is a man's world, is playing on the PA system. The crowds are in their thousands. There's a giant picture of Donald Trump is beamed down from a big screen, and there's a low-hanging morning sun beaming down on us in rural Pennsylvania here as a helicopter hovers above, about to come in, Donald Trump. When did you get out of bed this morning?
Got out of bed at 5:30. She woke me up.
Happy to be here?
Yeah. Pretty cool that he's coming to all the small towns and showing that he cares.
What will Donald Trump do for you?
I think he'll make life easier. Taxes, groceries, everyday living. Be able to survive.
Donald J. Trump!
He started with the policy substance, the economy, which, along with immigration, is Trump's top theme, targeted especially here in the Rust Belt.
You like it better now or 4 years ago? Well, I ask it a different... You like it better now or 4 years ago? And I've come today with a message of hope for all Americans. With your vote on Tuesday, I will end inflation. I will stop the invasion of massive numbers of criminals coming into our country. Thank you very much, Kamala and Joe. And I will bring back the American dream, and we'll bring it back stronger than ever before. But this is all you need to know. Kamala broke it, and we will fix it, and we're going to fix it fast.
The former president then veered way off the teleprompter. For 20 minutes, he assailed the election process in this critical swing state, 2 days before millions of voters vote. He claimed without evidence that a days-long count, which is likely in Pennsylvania, given how tight the race is, will be a sign of fraud. He said people were trying to steal the election from him.
Can you imagine? They spend all this money on machines, and they're going to say, we may take an extra 12 days to determine. And what do you think happens during that 12 days? What do you think happens?
They're cheating, shout some in the crowd.
Bunch of crooked people. These are crooked people.
Well, there's a crowd now spilling outside of the runway and the aircraft hangar beyond the barricades here, and a big screen outside. Some of the loudest cheers going up when Donald Trump has called the press, the Democrats, and the opinion polling all corrupt.
And I have this piece of glass here, but all we have really over here is the fake news, right? And to get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much, because I don't mind.
What did you think of when Donald Trump was saying that the election process here is being rigged, that Democrats are cheating?
It is. And it was 4 years ago.
Can I ask what you thought of the rally?
It's great. Great. Love. Companionship. Everybody was there for the same reason, for a good outturn on Tuesday. And I think God gave us our modern-day Moses to deliver us from these crooks.
The two candidates have poured time and money into campaigning in Pennsylvania.
For Harris, who many voters say they still don't know enough about, the challenge has been acute, pulling even with Trump since the summer, but unable to break the deadlock. In the town of Harrisburg, the local Democrats rally their volunteers. They know a margin of just a few tens of thousands of votes could swing the election here either way.
Well, I think it's going to be a very close race for the Senate race and the presidential.
Bob Casey, a Pennsylvania senator, is running for election for the fourth time. For fellow Democrats in Washington who forced Joe Biden off the ticket 3 months ago, they may have hoped their gamble would have produced clearer numbers by now.
Do you regret that you're not further ahead in the opinion polling?
I can't tell you how much I've been impressed by the progress that Kamala Harris made from July when President Biden decided not to run till today, because at that time, both here in Pennsylvania, I think a lot of other places around the country, we were in a deficit position. She's made up that deficit. Now it's pretty much a dead heat, but I think the momentum's on her side and on our side. A lot of that momentum has to do with what's happening here today.
On the faces of some canvassers, you can see the exhaustion. The mood is uncertain.
My name is Kat Knapp.
How are you feeling about the election?
Wow, well, that's a good question. I wish I could tell you. I have actually turned my feelings off at this point. It's all about less worry, more doing. So really right now, it's just about the heads down work needed and the voter engagement needed to win the election.
The opinion polls in Pennsylvania suggest that concerns about the candidate's character, especially Trump's, are less important to many voters than a feeling that they're simply on their side. This is a campaign of the visceral over the practical to decide whose world wins.
Tom Bateman reporting. Well, for the next 3 days, Justin will be presenting this programme from Washington, D.C. Right now, though, he's in North Carolina, which is one of the seven key swing states. We spoke earlier, first about Donald Trump's tone in this last stretch.
What the Democrats are saying is that it very much helps them, and they seem genuinely to believe that Donald Trump is much darker than he was, for instance, at the end of his 2016 campaign, when he became very focused and beat Hillary Clinton because he seemed to be a more disciplined candidate in those final weeks. What the Democrats are saying is those remarks about the press and potential violence against them, but also things he was saying recently about Liz Cheney, the Republican who is his great opponent. He talked about her being shot in the face. He also said in one of these rallies that he's been holding in the last few days that he thought he'd made a mistake when he gave up after 2020 and left the White House. So there are aspects of what he is saying at the moment that the Democrats believe is playing in their favor. Though I have to say, I talked to a Trump campaigner here in North Carolina, who said people like that kind of stuff. Trump supporters like it. They don't take it that seriously, and they're quite energized by it. So, and that's certainly been the case in the past. And I'm not sure the Democrats are necessarily right, but there's no doubt that the language at rally after rally has been pretty dark and sometimes quite aggressive.
And I wonder then about your observations when you've been talking to people in North Carolina, which is another one of the seven key states, the swing states. Do you feel that there is evidence that this kind of rhetoric, this kind of tone, the way the candidates are presenting themselves, is getting their vote out?
The big issue in North Carolina, and actually for Trump voters more generally, but particularly in North Carolina, which is a state that he should carry, it's been carried by Republicans since Obama won it in 2008, but not since then by any Democrats. And that there is this sense that if he can get young men to the polls, then he will win North Carolina and indeed win other swing states as well. And what I'm sensing, having been in North Carolina the last couple of days, is this feeling that there isn't any certainty that that is going to happen. There is a nervousness among Republicans about whether they can get people sufficiently to the polls on the day. And a lot of Republican voters have not voted early. More have voted early than used to, but still a lot haven't. And there's just a sort of sense that on that last day, there is quite a lot that could go wrong. And one poll suggesting that North Carolina might go to Harris, that she's ahead at the moment. It is only one poll.
And is it a very gender-divided election, that Kamala Harris is one of her strongest suits is women's rights and women's rights over their bodies?
I mean, the polls tell us that it's as gender-divided as any election in modern times in the United States. And there's a poll out in the state of Iowa, which has got a lot of attention because of the headline, which is that Harris wins Iowa, which I think most people think is unlikely. It certainly hasn't been a toss-up state recently. But the poll is suggesting that it has discovered large numbers of women, particularly older women, have had it with Trump, basically, and are going to vote for Harris. If that poll has picked up something that is relevant in other states as well, then that suggests Harris could not only win, but actually win quite big. But of course, it's a big if, because we simply won't know until after Election Day whether that has come true. But it is certainly true as we go into this election. Trump is depending on men, particularly young men, to come to the polls, and Harris depending on women, particularly older and particularly college-educated women, to get her there.
Justin, thanks.
It is now 12 minutes to 8, and it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Nick Baines, the Anglican Bishop of Leeds.
Good morning. I went to see Bob Dylan in Liverpool last night. Oddly enough, it felt to me like he was sandwiched between the election of a party leader on Saturday and an American president this week. For decades, Dylan has questioned power and the motivations of the people who wield it. Prophesying through his pen in hundreds of songs, he applies the poet's eyes and ears to what most of us either can't see or can't find the words to express. Now, this is the role of the prophet, to speak truth without fear or favour, in season and out of season. In this way, the poet shines the light into reality, not seeking votes or power, but using the power of words and image to question and to illuminate real motivations, subverting the noise and claims to power that abound in times of confusion or conflict. Now, I wonder how this might apply to the new leader of the Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch, as she seeks to renew a battered party for the future and in the wake of significant loss. Or the next president of the United States, as a deeply divided country handles truth in a discourse that almost has to be polarised to be heard. If leadership is to be prophetic, in the sense of enabling people to face reality and hear what might be uncomfortable, what price any attempt to unite under a single banner? If leadership has to be visionary, that is, shining a light on what the future might look like if a particular common path is to be walked down, how might a vision be proffered while the current conflicts are still raging? Well, we shall see. But common to both will be the place of truth-telling and truth-hearing. Prophetic leaders always have faced the same challenge. Moses led his people out of centuries of slavery, only to have them complaining, looking for alternative leaders who would give them what they want now, and romanticising the past's agonies. Jesus stands in silence before his judge, Pontius Pilate, who then finds himself being judged by the one who will not provide easy answers. Leadership, then, is never a means to becoming popular. Telling the truth rarely is. George Orwell's lines, etched into the wall of the BBC itself, might be true, but are often only welcome when applied to someone else. If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear. Well, back to Dylan. The tempests of our modern times might be unique, but they still demand the rough and rowdy ways of the prophetic poets.
That was Thought for the Day with Nick Baines, the Anglican Bishop of Leeds. It's now 10 to 8. At first sight, the death of 15-year-old Holly Newton, who was stabbed repeatedly with a kitchen knife, looked like a terrible, tragic example of the horror caused by young people carrying knives. The truth revealed at the trial of her killer, Logan MacPhail, though, was very different. He was her boyfriend, the first she'd ever had. His attack was premeditated, motivated, the judge said, by resentment and jealousy. Holly's mother said he'd appeared at first to be mild-mannered and polite. He'd even spent weekends with the family. But in the days before Holly's death, her mum came to realise that the 16-year-old boy they thought they knew was controlling her daughter coercing her to stay together. And Michaela and Holly's stepfather, Lee, are now campaigning to have the law changed to recognise that even those under 16 can be victims of domestic abuse. Michaela and Lee Trussler join me here in the BBC studios in Salford. Good morning. Thank you so much for coming in
Good
to
morning.
Talk to us about this. When you look back, which must be horribly painful to do, Michaela,
yeah.
do you see things in the final days of Holly's relationship that were, with the benefit of hindsight, signals that something wasn't quite right?
In the final few days, yes. We realised that things were wrong, not going well for Holly and Logan.
What were you seeing?
We found out that he was threatening to kill himself if she was to leave him. Obviously, that was a massive red flag. But also, he couldn't leave her alone. He was ringing her multiple times a day.
He was obsessed?
He was absolutely obsessed with her, yes.
And there was an incident, wasn't there, where they were dancing together and things were not quite right? They danced, I know, at home together,
yes,
didn't they?
Did.
And you
yes,
weren't comfortable with that relationship. Lee, does that make you think it is an awful question to ask a bereaved parent? But I know you will have asked it yourselves. Was there something we should have done?
Well, to be honest, once we noticed what was going on, we'd done everything we could to put an end to it. We're told Holly to block him on all social media, phone calls, messages, just block him. It is the safest thing to do. And then the next morning we rang the police to say, look at this, this is what's going on. He's been outside the house overnight. He's constantly messaging her. Once that had happened, that's all we could do is ring the police and say, this is what's gone on.
This is what we think the danger is. You want to change the law because at the moment, if somebody's under 16, the victim, that is,
yes.
it's deemed to be child abuse, not domestic abuse. Now, why would it be important, Michaela? Why do you think there'd be value in saying somebody can be in one of these coercive, controlling relationships, even when they're as young as Holly was?
I think it's important, obviously, to recognise that younger people are getting into relationships earlier and they need that support. And at the minute, they can't access that support because in the eyes of the law, they can't be victims of domestic abuse unless they are over 16.
But what sort of support, Lee, would it be if she'd been able to pick up the phone and say, look, I'm a victim of this? What might she have been able to get?
Different charities would be able to give you different things on what direction to go down. Like, just block them.
Yeah.
And that should do it. Or, right, we really need to get the police involved and give you different coping strategies or how to exit the relationship safely. There's loads of different avenues what could be used.
There's lots of places that secure an evacuation plan for victims of domestic abuse, and that's the most important thing. And I think for Holly, she didn't know how to exit safely.
And that's why, Michaela, you want to educate young people at school, but also their teachers, carers as well. You've got this new organisation called Holly's Hope.
Yes.
You've got kids 15, 12, 9.
Yes.
What sort of things should kids of their age be told, do you think?
I think, as honestly, as much as possible, I think it's important that they know what is normal and what is not normal. But also, I think we need to teach young boys what is normal and what is not normal, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable.
Lee, you think if Holly maybe had had those sorts of classes as a young girl, she would have known where to turn, what to do in a difficult situation?
I think if Holly had known what to look out for, it certainly would have, the relationship would have ended a lot sooner to what it did. So
it didn't end because she was scared, though, did it?
Yeah, it didn't end because she was scared of leaving him because of the threats he was making. But at that time, we didn't know about those threats.
That's the other important learning point here, isn't it, Michaela, which is young people, even loved children, won't necessarily tell their parents.
No, and teenagers can be very secretive. And I think that's also why it's important for this education plan, because they tend to talk more amongst themselves. So even if they're not going to go and speak to a parent, they know they can go to an organisation, or even just talk with their friends. And then obviously there's other ways of getting support than just parents, because we do understand that teenagers and parents, you know, their relationship's not always.
So Lee, if you could give that advice, if you were in front of a room full of young men, young women, what advice would you want to give them?
Talk to each other, support each other, and don't be afraid to tell parents what's going on, or an adult, your carers, anything. Don't be afraid to say what's going on, because if you are afraid to say what's going on, it could end up really bad.
Lee, Michaela, thank you very much indeed for talking to us about your lovely daughter, 15-year-old Holly Newton, and what we can all learn from her awful death. Thank you.
Thanks.
And we'll put some of that to the Home Secretary when she joins us after 8 o'clock. But with US Election Day almost upon us, here's how it will be covered on the BBC.
America Decides with Ros Atkins and Nuala McGovern.
We are going to take you to the United States on a momentous night, a moment in history.
Live coverage of the 2024 US presidential election as results are declared.
It's definitely going to be exciting.
We're going to get the first real indications who the next president's going to be.
It's going to be dramatic.
And of course, that affects us all.
America Decides.
Throughout tomorrow night from 10.
I'm looking forward to seeing how this night plays out.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
At 2 minutes to eight, the latest on the very warm weather. Helen Willits.
Nick, thank you very much. Yes, we've got high pressure with us this week, so the cloudy trend of the weekend continues with subtle day-to-day changes. As the southerly wind picks up, temperatures, yes, they will be above average by day and by night, and hopefully they'll punch a few more holes in the cloud. But for today, across England and Wales, it is predominantly cloudy. The clouds just thick enough for the odd spot of drizzle in the breeze, nothing more. A little bit of mist and of fog very locally, but it's been a cloudy and therefore mild night. It'll be a cloudy and reasonably bright day once the sun comes up properly, and we'll see perhaps a little bit of that sunshine breaking through the clouds in the southeast of England and perhaps the west of Wales and southwest England. If so, 14 or 15 will be the high today, generally 12 though, where we've got the cloudier skies with a gentle breeze. Northern Ireland have thicker cloud, and actually it is giving a little bit of drizzle around, but again most will be dry for much of the day, just 12 or 13 under the cloudy skies. And the cloudy skies follow us into Scotland as well, although it's been a chilly start in the north of Scotland. Temperatures not close to freezing in Aboyne, and so it's here in the north of Scotland where we'll see the best of the day's sunshine. But again, for the northern and western Isles, the clouds thick enough at times for the odd spot of drizzle near the west coast and indeed the east coast. But if it brightens up, 12, 13, possibly 14 on the cards for the day ahead.
Helen, thank you very much. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussein.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 4th of November. The headlines this morning. Sir Keir Starmer is pledging to stamp out what he calls the vile trade in people, which has brought thousands of migrants across the Channel in small boats. After this news, we'll be speaking to the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper. The US election campaign is entering its final hours with the two candidates focusing on the handful of states which will decide the race. And the Foreign Secretary said the concept of reparations for slavery is not about the transfer of cash.
Coming up in the next hour, our North America editor Sarah Smith meets voters in the key state of Pennsylvania, including some who are still undecided.
I'm a registered Democrat, but I'm a gun shooter, and I believe in border protection, and I believe in, you know, so I'm all over the map. So it's very difficult for me to say, oh, I'm going to run with this candidate, I'm going to run with this candidate.
And how this year's grape harvest in the south of England is being attacked by pigeons. We'll hear from a winemaker in Surrey. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The Prime Minister is to announce that an extra £75 million is to be spent on tackling what he'll call the national threat of gangs smuggling people across the Channel. Sir Keir Starmer will emphasise the global challenge of illegal migration when he addresses the Interpol General Assembly in Glasgow today. The Conservatives said the extra funding would mean absolutely nothing unless there was also a deterrent to stop migrants making the dangerous journey. Our Home Editor, Mark Easton, reports from Glasgow.
30,000 people have crossed the Channel in small boats already this year, more than half of those since Labour came to power in July. The numbers emphasise the challenge the government has set itself to smash the smuggling gangs. Having ditched the Tories' plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda, it's pinning its hopes on domestic law enforcement and international cooperation. Around £60 million will be spent on buying surveillance technology, covert cameras and other spy equipment to help UK police infiltrate and undermine the organised criminals. The remainder is for specialist investigators and prosecutors. The arrival of representatives from 195 countries at the Interpol event, held this year in Glasgow, is also an opportunity for UK officials to discuss closer working relationships along the length of migrant journeys, from source countries to the beaches of Kent.
Kevin Saunders, who's a former chief immigration officer for ports, told this programme the plan wasn't feasible because most of the people smugglers were outside the UK's jurisdiction.
The only ones that you can actually prosecute and send to prison are the ones in the United Kingdom. And the majority of the people smugglers are actually based in the Middle East. He's got to come up with a deterrent to make the migrants not want to come to the UK. If the migrants don't want to come to the UK, the smugglers won't be there to bring them.
Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have been campaigning relentlessly to woo voters in the small number of states which are likely to decide who enters the White House. Ahead of tomorrow's presidential election, opinion polls suggest the result could be extremely close. Our North America editor Sarah Smith is following the campaign.
In this incredibly tight race, both candidates are frantically campaigning for every last vote. Donald Trump is already alleging that Democrats are trying to steal the election. He also told supporters at a rally in Georgia he was on course for victory.
So with your vote on Tuesday, we're going to fire Kamala and we are going to save America. We will cut your taxes, end inflation, slash your prices, raise your wages.
Kamala Harris has been harshly critical of Mr. Trump, but has now stopped mentioning his name as she says she wants to end her campaign on an upbeat note.
Our campaign is tapping into the ambitions, the aspirations, and the dreams of the American people because we are optimistic and excited about what we can do together.
What has often been an angry and aggressive battle for the White House will end with them both holding competing rallies in the biggest swing state, Pennsylvania, later today. Not every vote is still up for grabs. Early voting arrangements in many states mean over 76 million voters have already cast their ballots. That's almost half the total number of people who voted in the whole of the 2020 election.
Moldova's pro-European president, Maia Sandu, has won a second term, defeating Alexander Stoianoglo, who's backed by the pro-Russian Socialist Party. Official figures give her an unassailable lead, with almost all of the votes counted. President Sandu thanked voters living outside the country, saying they'd saved Moldova from hostile foreign forces, a reference to alleged Russian election interference, which Moscow denies.
Moldova, you are victorious. Today, dear Moldovans, you have given a lesson in democracy, worthy of being written in the history books. Today, you have saved Moldova. In this choice for a dignified future, no one lost.
The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has said the concept of reparations for former colonies affected by slavery is not about the transfer of cash. They're his first comments since 56 Commonwealth leaders signed a joint letter saying the time had come to talk about the issue. From Lagos, here's our West Africa correspondent, Nkechi Obana.
David Lammy is on his first visit to Africa as Foreign Secretary. Just over a week ago, conversations grew louder about the need to pay reparations to former colonies affected by slave trade. When asked about slavery reparations, he said it is not about finance.
That is not the debate I think that people are wanting to have. They're wanting to talk about the future. What I'm interested in is looking forward, looking to the future.
Speaking in Lagos, a Nigerian port city once central to the transatlantic slave trade, Mr. Lammy said it was right that the UK had previously apologised for its role in slavery. He says Africa has much potential and the UK needs a new approach to this continent, which they've stepped back from over the last few years. On his trip, Mr. Lammy will visit Nigeria and South Africa, two major economies on the continent. He has suggested a five-month consultation period with African nations about a future relationship.
In the past few minutes, it's been reported that the musician and record producer Quincy Jones has died. He was 91. Quincy Jones was a musical arranger, film composer and trumpeter, but was perhaps best known for his work with Michael Jackson. Richard Foster looks back at his life.
As a child, Quincy Jones tried to steal food from a military store. What he found shaped his future.
Saw a little spinet piano over in the corner. The first time I ever touched it, every cell in my body said, "This is what you're going to do the rest of your life."
He arranged songs for Dinah Washington, Ray Charles and Frank Sinatra, and wrote the classic Soul Bossa Nova. Quincy wrote scores for 33 films. While working on the film The Wiz, he met Michael Jackson. He produced three of Jackson's albums, Off the Wall, Bad, and the best-selling ever, Thriller. Michael Jackson said Quincy knew just what he wanted.
You say, we have a take. Then you say, but can you give us one more?
Quincy Jones won 27 Grammy Awards and an Oscar. The music industry has lost one of its most important producers.
Who's bad?
A new report says there could be up to a quarter of a million more flats with dangerous cladding than previously thought. A report from the National Audit Office says there could be more than 7,000 tower blocks still unidentified, which will be subject to the government scheme to fix them. Phil Hendry has more details.
The report shows just how little has been done since the Grenfell tragedy 7 years ago to make flats safe. There are just under 5,000 blocks, the equivalent of more than a quarter of a million homes, currently known to the government. Only a third have had cladding replaced so far. Now it's been revealed that by the Ministry of Housing's own estimates, there could be more than 7,000 more blocks yet to be identified. The total repair bill could be more than £16 billion. The report says residents and flat owners still awaiting repairs continue to suffer what it calls significant financial and emotional distress. The government says it will come up with a plan to speed up repairs later this autumn.
A volcanic explosion in eastern Indonesia has killed at least 9 people. Reports say lava, ash and rocks spewed more than 3 miles from Mount Letobi Laki. The Prince of Wales will arrive in Cape Town this morning for this year's Earthshot Prize ceremony. 5 prizes of £1 million each will be awarded to the best environmental innovations. Our royal correspondent Daniela Ralph reports from Cape Town.
Hosting the Earthshot Prize in Africa is personal for Prince William. He says it's here that he found solace as a teenager after the death of his mother. It's where he proposed to his wife 14 years ago. And his Earthshot idea was born in Namibia during a visit in 2018. He'll spend this week in Cape Town, meeting finalists pitching for the £1 million prize awarded for solutions to the biggest climate challenges, from earthquake-resilient bricks to saving a breed of antelope from extinction. On Wednesday night, the Earthshot Prize ceremony will be held in a vast, reusable eco-dome. It will include a musical performance from the top of Table Mountain.
Daniela Ralph reporting.
Caroline, thank you very much. The time is 8:10. Tens of millions of pounds of extra funding is being announced today to help the government reach its goal of smashing the criminal gangs who get people across the channel in small boats. Most of the money will go on high-tech equipment, such as surveillance. But the task is immense and, some say, impossible to achieve through the tactics this government is employing alone. In the words of the former senior immigration officer we heard from an hour ago, none of this will stop the boats. A deterrent, he said, is vital. And removing people is not enough of a deterrent because many cannot be removed. They have destroyed their passports. There is no evidence of which country should be taking them back. The latest numbers on the crossings are these. 30,000 small boat arrivals this year. Half have come in the 4 months since the election. Perhaps it's the summer, or perhaps it is in part due to there no longer being a risk of being deported to Rwanda. Well, Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, joins us from Glasgow, where an Interpol conference is taking place today. Good morning, Home Secretary.
Good morning, Michelle.
What do you think you can bring the numbers of small boat crossings down to with the approach that you're taking?
Well, we believe that much more needs to be done to stop the criminal gangs who are organising the dangerous boat crossings, who are undermining border security and putting lives at risk. And they have been getting away with it for far too long. There hasn't been any serious international cooperation to go after the criminal gang networks. Organised immigration crime has not been taken sufficiently seriously as part of the work on serious organised crime. And that's the argument that we are making at Interpol at this International Law Enforcement Conference today, and also why we're announcing the £150 million of new investment into the Border Security Command, which will in itself bring together the National Crime Agency, the Border Force, set up new specialist intelligence officers, international liaison officers, and the new technology and equipment that we need to have a massive increase in the actions and operations against the criminal gangs.
Let's focus on the international cooperation side, because of the conference that you're at today, because of how you've written about this issue in this morning's Telegraph. Are you therefore asking the German government to make it illegal to transport the kinds of boats that cross the channel across their country?
Well, we are working with the German government at the moment. The Prime Minister and the German Chancellor announced their intention to draw up a new joint action plan around these issues around organised immigration crime, and that includes particularly focusing on the supply chains. So you've had BBC reports, for example, around warehouses identified in Germany.
Yeah. Can I ask you specifically, asking them to make it illegal? Because that's one of the problems, isn't it? If you get stopped by the police and you've got a load of dinghies in the back of a lorry, the police can't do anything. If you're a legitimate supplier, no questions asked.
Yeah, so one of the things we are working with them on is exactly these issues around what more law enforcement action can be taken, what more prosecution actions can be taken, what can be done around existing German law, what can be done around new partnerships and new arrangements.
And asking them to change the law?
Well, we will set out an update on that new arrangement before Christmas. I'm not going to preempt the final stages of the discussions that we have underway at the moment, but I can tell you that we are working very closely with Germany on how we substantially upgrade the action against supply chains.
And are you agreed on it? Is the German government pushing back at any of your requests, or are you completely aligned?
So those are the issues that we're working very closely on at the moment. I've had discussions with the German Ministry of the Interior. We have a real shared interest in how we tackle these criminal gangs. There's some of the smuggler routes, not just around the supply chains, but also the way that people are moved through the smuggler and trafficking networks that also go through Germany from other parts of the world as well. So we have some shared interests around this, and that's why we're working so closely together. But that kind of cooperation between the UK and other European countries just hasn't been happening. Under the previous government, we just didn't have that real shared, strong cooperation around law enforcement, and that is what we are upgrading
now. People really seem to be beyond the reach of European law enforcement. You referred to one BBC investigation. There was another one in the To Catch a Scorpion podcast. The smuggler was only arrested after he'd been identified in that BBC podcast. He was arrested in Iraq. But can he be extradited? Can he be prosecuted here?
Well, those are all of the issues that we are working to strengthen at the moment. So that means international law enforcement agreements. It means stronger arrangements around whether it be extraditions, whether it be prosecutions within individual home countries. But those are the things that simply have not happened in a coordinated way. So, you know, talking at Interpol, we've obviously had action against serious and organised crime over generations through Interpol, but we've not had sufficiently strong action against this organised immigration crime, which is so dangerous.
That's why I ask you, as I did right at the beginning, what do you think that you can bring the numbers of small boat crossings down to with the approach you are taking? So we've had 30,000 arrivals so far this year. If it is the same by this time next year, will you think that something more is needed, perhaps something like offshore processing or indeed something similar to the Rwanda scheme?
So we do clearly need to make significant progress, because it is dangerous what's happening, and it undermines border security. In terms of the Rwanda scheme that was in place under the previous government, it ran for 2.5 years. They spent £700 million And they sent four volunteers, just four volunteers. That is not a system that was working or was working as any kind of deterrent to anyone or any in any way at all. In terms of the numbers that we had while the Rwanda scheme was operating in the first half of the year, those were the highest on record that we inherited. The first half of the year under the Conservatives, under the Rwanda scheme, the crossings were the highest on record for that time of the year.
Hang on, we've had half worried of this year's crossings in the last 4 months. That's course, since you've been elected.
Seasonal. It's always seasonal. But if you look at it for different parts of the year compared to previous years, the first half of the year was the highest for the first 6 months of the year of any year on record. We were really worried that would continue through the rest of the year. That hasn't happened. The July, August, September figures were lower than previous years, but October has been higher. Of course, there are weather issues that affect that. So the Met Office, for example, identified much higher numbers of what they call the sort of calm crossing days in October. But we can't just be at the mercy of the weather on these things. You have to go after the criminal gangs that are at the heart of this.
But you're not telling us how, to what extent you think you can be successful. You're being very careful not to put any numbers on it. And I realise why, because these things are difficult. But people need to have confidence that you believe what you are putting together will seriously dent these numbers.
So we do believe that this can make progress, and we do believe that significant progress is needed.
What the Prime Minister, the current numbers?
What the Prime Minister will say on this is the work when he was the Director of Public Prosecutions, that the work he saw, coordinated cooperation across Europe, for example, to go after the extremist and terror gangs and networks, he saw that have a huge impact, make a real difference in going after those networks. And that's why he's
really
so clear that this
big
can
business.
Be done.
This is a business model which is highly successful, and however expensive the crossings are, people are willing to pay for it.
You're right that it is a criminal industry, and that's why you have to go after the illicit finance. That's the new cooperation we have in place with Italy. That's why you have to go after the supply chains, and why you have to go after the gang operations as well. So obviously, look, what I'm not going to do is to do just to deal with slogans, which is what Rishi Sunak did when, you know, he had slogans and promised the whole thing was going to be solved in a year.
Processing?
So we think the Rwanda scheme obviously failed completely.
That wasn't processing, was it? That was deportation.
Exactly.
So might you consider offshore processing, as many European countries are? Return hubs, they call them.
Yeah, so there is the Italy-Albania arrangement that is a new arrangement that's being put in place. We obviously watch that closely. Part of what's interesting about that arrangement is what they are seeking to do is for people who have arrived or trying to reach Italy from predominantly safe countries would then have decisions fast-tracked, and they would still be processed as part of the Italian asylum system, and then those decisions would be fast-tracked and returned. We are looking to develop a fast-track system, which within the UK, you think if you've got people arriving from safer countries, we should be able to speed up those decisions and speed up returns. And we have had a 23% increase in enforced returns for failed asylum cases over the summer as part of what we're doing.
But overall, the trajectory of returns going up has really been the case since about the middle of 2021. I do want to ask you something specific.
Well, but that was after it had dropped massively.
Fine, but it's been going
after
up.
2010.
It's not just
failed.
That it's gone up. So we have this year or since you've been in
power.
But
we immediately shifted resources into returns.
Okay.
Straight after the election, we have substantially increased the resources on returns. So that is a result of what the work we have been doing.
There's a very specific point that Kevin Saunders, who we shouldn't forget was a very senior immigration officer, he was the chief immigration officer for ports, a specific point he put to us, which I think is important, which is that there are large numbers of people who cannot be deported because they know that if they destroy their passport, when you and the Home Office then try and approach the country that you think they're from and say, we've got one of your citizens, take them back, they say, where's the evidence that they're from this country? And there isn't such evidence. So those people, in his words, get to stay here for life.
Well, you're right that that has been what's happened in the past because there hasn't been strong enough focus around returns and enforcement. So we have, since the election, substantially increased the resources for returns and enforcement. We've put up to 1,000 additional staff into
passport?
That. Well, there will also be all kinds of evidence around people's identity. It's not just dependent on the particular passports people have. We develop, as part of returns arrangements with other countries, agreements and arrangements for being able to identify people, even if they don't have passports. So that has been done in the past, continues to be done, and we believe that work can be expanded as well. So I don't think we should just throw up our hands and say, oh, it's all too difficult. We have deliberately increased the returns and enforcement investment over the summer, and that is having an impact. We've had increased number of direct chartered flights that have been returned, including some very substantial and significant ones. We do believe there's much more that we can do. You're right, Michelle, that none of this is easy, but we've inherited a system that was just in total chaos in July. I mean, really shocking chaos throughout the system. We are step by step trying to get a grip of the whole system and put things back on track.
While you're with us, I do want to ask you about the case of Holly Newton.
Yeah.
Who was 15 when she was murdered by her former boyfriend. We talked to her mother and stepfather a short time ago, and they are campaigning for a change in the law on domestic abuse because of her age, because she was under 16, she cannot be considered a victim of domestic abuse. Do you recognise that, and do you think the law should be changed to allow for under 16 victims of domestic abuse?
So I think this is a really serious issue, and I would have all sympathy with Holly's family. I can't imagine what they will have gone through. This was a truly awful case. Of course, there is domestic abuse in teenage relationships. There is violence within teenage relationships that we have seen increasing, and it really troubles me that we have seen it increasing. Of course, we want to look at the ways that we make sure that the police properly record cases of violence against women and girls in the right way, but also that we take the action against it. And that does include work in schools on teenage relationships, something that Bridget Phillipson is determined to do as part of the wider mission that we have set for the next 10 years to halve the level of violence against women and girls.
What's your answer to Holly's parents on changing the law on domestic abuse?
So we will specifically look at this, because we need to make sure that we have got the right ways of recording this kind of violence in teenage relationships. I do think that this is an extremely important issue, and we have to take seriously the points that they have made.
Home Secretary Yvette Cooper, thank you.
Thank you.
It is 23 minutes past eight now. She has been cracking jokes on Saturday Night Live. He has been accusing her supporters of being demonic and trying to steal the election. Yes, it is now election week indeed. The election itself is tomorrow, Tuesday, the choice between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, reflects now on the issues motivating their supporter and meets one. There are still some undecided voter in this report from Harrisburg in Pennsylvania.
The annual Strasburg Swing Dance in the swing state of Pennsylvania is a deliberately nostalgic event. On the dance floor, women are wearing 1940s-style dresses and hairdos. Some of the men are in Second World War uniforms. But in a battleground state like this, there is no avoiding the imminent election. A choice between Kamala Harris, who says she represents the future.
But America, we are not going back.
Or the former president, who asked voters, have you missed me?
Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?
During a quick break from the jiving and the jitterbugs, I met one of the very few undecided voters left in America, medical researcher Rebecca Webb.
I'm a registered Democrat, but I'm a gun shooter, and I believe in border protection, and I believe in, you know, so I'm all over the map. So it's very difficult for me to say, oh, I'm going to run with this candidate.
And does anything about Donald Trump's personality put you off some of the more...
Yeah, he needs to shut the hell up. He needs to shut his mouth up. I mean, you know, he may have good platforms, but he's got a potty mouth. That's not necessary.
Would that stop you voting for him?
It could, yeah. That could.
Kamala Harris could get your vote.
She could.
Do you think she will?
I don't know. I reserve the right to say I'm going to wake up Tuesday morning and make my decision. It may be at the voting booth and I go, nope, you know. It's like, do I turn left or right? I'm like, no, I'm going to go straight today.
Thank you very much. We have two more tunes for this set. Next up is a polka. Hoop-dee-doo.
kind of indecision is incomprehensible to most of the voters in this sharply divided nation. Many Harris supporters simply cannot understand why she's not further ahead of a convicted felon who's been described as a fascist by his own former chief of staff. And then there's the Trump voters, who can't believe anyone could vote for a candidate who's been in the White House while illegal border crossings have reached record levels and inflation has soared.
My body!
My choice!
My body!
10,000 women marched through Washington at the weekend in support of Kamala Harris and particularly her promise to try to restore abortion rights, one of the other big issues in this campaign.
This is like do or die this time, yeah.
Philippia Hellman says for women, it's existential.
As everybody's pushing against our given rights for what we want to do, and so we need to stand up and defend those.
Wendy Wilkinson couldn't imagine not voting for Kamala Harris, especially given the alternative.
Our mothers fought for our rights to choose, to take care of our bodies, to have health care and not die just because we're having a miscarriage. His behavior every single day is proof enough that we could not ever vote for this man. He doesn't take care of humans, much less women.
A defining feature of this election is the yawning gender gap that's emerged among voters. Kamala Harris says very little about the historic nature of her candidacy, that she could become the first female president, but she does have the support of record numbers of women. As I've been covering this campaign, it has been really noticeable the extent to which Americans basically live in isolated bubbles where they never meet or interact with people who have different political views. And as a result, voters often tell me they are very sure their candidate's going to win because they've never met anyone who's voting for the other side. The outcome, whatever it is, of Tuesday's election is a terrifying prospect to half of this deeply divided nation.
When I say we are, you say
they say!
Tailgating really is a uniquely American pastime. Before any big game, people gather around their cars, drinking beer and downing shots, grilling burgers and hot dogs. Basically, it's a big party in a car park. At Beaver Stadium in central Pennsylvania, the Penn State University football team is about to take on Ohio State.
Oh, this is huge. So we waited all season to meet, you know, Ohio State.
So you're anticipating victory?
Absolutely, yeah. We're not going to go into a game thinking otherwise.
Jeff and Brian were college roommates and decades later are still tailgating together.
And the election year, is confident about that?
That it won't be by 7, but for Pennsylvania itself, I feel it'll be Trump by 2, pull out a win for the whole country.
Why do you want to see Donald Trump re-elected president?
I think he's the person to restore confidence in our country. Kamala doesn't give me the confidence that she has the true experience.
Sometimes he says quite outrageous things.
I think that's the key, though. Like, I feel that Donald Trump is talking for me, like, saying, hey, this is ridiculous. I need something to change. We need something to change. I mean, this country is not in great shape, but it's one of the greatest countries in the world. But I think Donald Trump can bring us back to prosperity and where we need to be.
Whether it's men versus women, rural versus urban, or the marked gap between voters who have a college degree and those who don't, this country is split into two distinct tribes who just don't understand each other. And only one side can win. The result of this election, whoever wins, will come as a deep shock to many millions of Americans.
A little more on the election before 9 o'clock with Justin, but now the sport with Cathy.
Morning, thank you very much. Despite an enthusiastic celebration from Ruud van Nistelrooy when Manchester United scored against Chelsea, their lead didn't last long. That game finished as a 1-1 draw. Chelsea in fourth place now, but it remains United's worst start to a Premier League campaign with just 12 points from their opening 10 games. Tottenham came from behind to beat Aston Villa 4-1. Holders Rangers beat Motherwell 2-1 to secure their place in the Scottish League Cup final against Celtic. And Manchester City atop of the Women's Super League, they had a 3-0 win over Crystal Palace. Now, it was a tricky race in wet conditions for all of the Formula One drivers in Brazil, apart from, it seems, Max Verstappen, who climbed up from 17th place on the grid to win the Sao Paulo Grand Prix, while the British driver Lando Norris started on pole but ended up in 6th place. It is the first time the three-time world champion has been back on the top step of the podium since the Spanish Grand Prix in June. And after the race, I spoke to the Telegraph's senior sports correspondent, Tom Carey, who is in the Sao Paulo paddock, about how impressed he was with Verstappen's driving.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary drive. I mean, really one of the sort of best wet weather drives I can think of, to be honest. You know, right up there with Ayrton Senna at Donington all those years ago, or Lewis Hamilton himself in 2008. You know, everyone else was struggling to keep their car on the track, and he was just so much faster than everyone else. He set multiple fastest laps. I mean, I think 10 of his last 11 laps would have been fastest lap. Even without the red flags in the middle of the race, he might have won that on his own merit.
He is a three-time world champion. You mentioned it's up there with some of the greatest races. Do you think that's his greatest race?
Well, he said it was afterwards. I think given what's on the line at the moment, now that the situation has changed so drastically, we forget that just a few hours ago, he was looking likely to lose a lot of points to Lando Norris in the title race. The pressure was massively on him and Red Bull, and he had a lot of work to do, and he could not afford any errors in really treacherous, slippery conditions, given the pressure that was on him. He said himself that he felt it was his best.
It was such a changing day, as you mentioned there. Lando Norris was on pole, but finished in sixth position. He is now 62 points behind Verstappen. There are 86 points still available in the final three races in that one sprint. Are Lando Norris's title hopes pretty much over now?
Pretty much, or definitely. I can't imagine that Verstappen's going to have two or three DNFs. In fact, if Verstappen finishes in front of Norris in any which way, shape or form in Las Vegas in a few weeks' time, then he will be champion already. So he's pretty much got one hand on the trophy already. Yeah, and I think you could tell by the way Lando Norris reacted afterwards that he knew it was over.
Huge amount of disappointment there, wasn't there? And one of the biggest celebrations was from the Alpine team, with Esteban Ocon and Pierre Gasly finishing on the podium in second and third respectively. Can you just put into context why that's such a surprise and why it was so important for them as well?
Yeah, hugely important. That team has been going through just so much tumult in the last few seasons. They haven't had anything like those results. Some of the best drivers in the world, such as Lewis Hamilton, were right at the back. Yeah, that was a brilliant result for them.
Thanks very much, Tom Carey.
No worries.
And the next race is in Las Vegas after a two-week break. Just to mention, the season-ending WTA tennis finals taking place in Saudi Arabia. For the first time, despite some criticism, Iga Swiatek beat the Wimbledon champion Barbora Krejcikova, and Coco Gauff defeated her doubles partner Jessica Pegula in the round-robin matches on day two.
Thank you so much, Carthy. Adam Rutherford's here in the studio because it is time to start the week. Morning, Adam.
Morning, Michelle. So we've got farming with a difference today, with leather, feathers and straw. We've got the shepherd James Rebanks. He's abandoned his flock temporarily to spend some time on a remote Norwegian island, learning the ways of the eider duck, the one whose breast down puffs our duvets. What could modern farmers learn from such an ancient practice? Now, I'm a Suffolk boy, so the thatched roof is very much part of my world. This sustainable form of roofing continues to be part of the British way of life. Master thatcher Andrew Raffle shows us the ropes. And a mere byproduct of cattle farming is leather. The fashion designer Alice Robinson has traced the path of one animal, bullock 374, from field to abattoir to tannery to handbag. So it's a thatcher, a shepherd and a bullock, all coming up at nine on The Archers. I mean, stuff.
Look forward to that. Thank you very much indeed. What's the weather got in store for us? Well, mainly dry and cloudy for most, with just a few brighter spells developing in the west and far southeast later. A few light showers possible under the cloud, mainly in the north.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in Salford, Michelle Hussein in London, Caroline Nichols with the news.
The government is pledging to double the security funding to tackle gangs smuggling migrants across the Channel. Sir Keir Starmer will emphasise the global challenge of illegal migration when he addresses the Interpol General Assembly in Glasgow today. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, told us there hadn't been any serious international cooperation in dealing with gangs, and they'd been getting away with it for far too long. The musician and record producer Quincy Jones has died at the age of 91. He was best known as the producer of Michael Jackson's Thriller album, but also worked with Frank Sinatra and wrote dozens of film scores. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have been campaigning relentlessly to win over any undecided voters in key swing states, with just a day to go before the US presidential election. Opinion polls suggest the result could be extremely close. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has said the concept of reparations for former colonies affected by slavery is not about the transfer of cash. Last month, 56 Commonwealth leaders signed a joint letter saying the time had come to talk about the issue.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. More coming about the life and times of Quincy Jones, who I discovered this morning lived across the road from Picasso in Paris in the 1950s. Quite a life. We'll talk about that in a few minutes' time. But now at 25 to 9, let's focus on the fallout from the budget. I was wrong to say during the election I wouldn't put taxes up. The Chancellor conceded yesterday, although Rachel Reeves was clear that she hadn't got plans to put those taxes up, that she'd hidden. She had, she insisted instead, been shocked by the state of the public finances she discovered on taking office. Now, the tax she chose was, as we all know now, employers' national insurance, something she used to call a jobs tax. So what impact will it have on business? Well, up the road from where I'm broadcasting this morning in Salford is the Bolton-based electrical retailer AO and its founder and chief executive, the man sometimes known as the Kitchen King, John Roberts, joins us here in Salford in Media City in the studio, a man who set up his business after taking a £1 bet in a pub. John.
Good morning, Nick.
Welcome back to the Today programme. Very nice to talk to you. Well, you were watching the budget. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that the question really for me is it going to be a tax and spend budget? Is it going to be a tax and invest budget or a tax and waste budget? And one thing's for sure is it's definitely a tax budget. So I think the jury's out on that. I think the big question is, do the Labour Party have the political stomach and appetite for the reforms that are going to be required? So, you know, if we're just going to pour more and more money into things like the NHS without the reform that's associated with it, then this could be a very dangerous budget because the debt is definitely going to stay with us. However, if the reform goes with it and actually we start to make change and deliver more productivity and better services, then it could be a great catalyst and it could be a growth engine for the country. So once those plans are laid out, and obviously we don't have any of the plans yet, all we have so far is what tax we're getting and what debt we're getting.
And is that making you nervous, the fact that we've got the bad news, but we haven't got what you hope is the good news?
Yeah, well, so I don't think we've definitely got, when you call it bad news, I think we're, as a nation, we're facing into some realities. And so on the one hand, it's nice to see that those being faced into and hopefully going to be dealt with. The truth is we won't know whether that is going to be dealt with until we see the plans for the money.
So the question is, what will you as a business leader do about what Rachel Reeves once called the jobs tax? It's got more expensive for you to employ people, not just because of this tax, but also because of new regulations around workers' rights. And for those of you workers who are on minimum wage, a higher national living wage as well. Does that mean in the end, brutally, you just have to employ fewer people?
Well, we have to deliver amazing services is the first start point for it. So it's how do we do that ruthlessly efficiently? So for us, there should be no great structural change. You know, we've said, I say consistently in our business that costs walk into businesses on legs. Those legs just got more expensive. So obviously, we will now need to look at how we can be more productive. There are topics like AI. How do we take cost out? From an AO perspective, we're a growth business, so it's more about how we don't increase our overhead as we grow.
So as you grow, it will be more worthwhile to invest in technology and in particular in AI than ever it was.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, sure, you know, AI is a direction of travel. From our point of view, we think about that through a customer lens of customer first.
Give us an example, because we often talk about it, this bit of jargon, but what will be different?
A few things that we're doing is how do you use AI for better routing on vehicles, for example, that give you a smaller, more convenient time window to deliver for customers and do that more efficiently so that you use less fuel, which takes cost out and improves the service for customers. Another great example is we've got, you know, we get hundreds of thousands, we've got, I think, 600,000 or something reviews on Trustpilot that you would pay people to trawl through anything that was negative in that. Well, AI can do all that heavy lifting work so that the people can be focused on learning from anything that we get wrong rather than just trawling through.
You're a growing business. You're an optimistic guy by nature. So you're not talking of losing jobs, but as you talk to colleagues in the business world, in Bolton, elsewhere here in the Northwest, are they worrying now jobs are going to go?
Yeah, so for sure, you know, over the last week, the mood music has changed to things like conversations around how AI can take cost out, which means take people out and automate jobs. And also conversations, again, I've heard a lot in the last few days around things like offshoring.
Now, James Dyson has written, the founder, of course, of Dyson, like you, a man who founded a business. He's written in the Times today, and he's a very angry man indeed, about what he calls the family death tax, and suggests that it will be the death to entrepreneurship.
Yeah, so I think that's nonsense. I think anybody that was going to found a business as an entrepreneur that is now not going to do it because of tax, frankly, Rachel Rees has done them a favour. They shouldn't have started that business in the first place.
Do you think it is a problem on the other hand, for a family business? He might want to leave his business to his son. Yeah. You're not doing that. You've brought in money from other investors. Is that a problem?
I think family businesses are at the absolute heart of the nation. They are great stewards. They think long term. They tend to be good employers. And there's this sort of mythical, cheap political point that anything over £1 million is a lot of money. Well, in business terms, that's just really not. And so the money is not just sat in those businesses waiting to be paid out. So, and this is true of businesses, as it is the same topic on farms, by the way, that to pay the tax, they are then going to have to sell things. And in a lot of cases, maybe put the whole business up for sale just to pay the tax. And that's not good for the long-term economy.
A rethink for the Chancellor, you think?
Definitely for me.
John Roberts, founder and CEO of AO. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
It is 19 minutes to nine. Few are brave enough to call the outcome of the US election at this stage, but Justin will be co-presenting from Washington tomorrow as America votes. And ahead of Election Day, he's been speaking to Democrat strategist Jim Messina, who ran Barack Obama's re-election campaign in 2012. How does he rate where the two campaigns are?
When I talk to both campaigns for my TV appearances, they both feel very strongly that the data says they're going to win. We haven't seen that sort of mismatch in the data since 2012, a campaign I ran for Barack Obama, where both sides thought they were going to win. And of course, Obama did. So I think this thing is going to be really, really close.
What do you make of the Iowa poll that suggests that Kamala Harris is ahead in Iowa, to the enormous surprise of virtually everyone, really?
Well, I hate public polling, as you well know, and I'm kind of famous for saying it's mostly garbage. That said, Ann Seltzer, the Iowa pollster, has historically been very, very right. Do I think that Kamala Harris is going to win Iowa? No, I don't. But what I think the numbers show you is momentum, enthusiasm, and that's really important. You know, Donald Trump won the voters in 2016 and 2020 who decided the last week of the election. Both campaigns have privately said to me that the data says that undecided voters are moving towards Harris. And you can kind of feel that in the Iowa poll. You can also see the largest gender gap in the history of American politics. Women surging for Harris, men surging for Trump. And you start to get really weird results like the Iowa poll.
Yeah, the gender gap is fascinating, isn't it? And could be, in the end, the determining factor.
Oh, absolutely. Like, the Harris campaign's entire theory here is the gender gap is going to take them over the line. And since the Dobbs decision, that's a decision that got rid of national abortion in America, women voters have turned out in historic numbers in elections. When you look at the early votes, some 32 million Americans have already early voted. 55% of them are women. That is a historic number that shows you just how enthusiastic women are. And if I'm the Harris campaign, that number gives me great confidence. On the other hand, if I'm the Trump campaign, early vote also shows that Republicans are voting in bigger numbers than Democrats. So there's numbers in the data that give both sides real kind of confidence going into these final 48 hours.
I remember you telling me last year that Democrats were praying for Donald Trump to be the candidate, and then he became the candidate. Has he surprised you in his abilities, quite apart from everything else about him, just as his ability to get to this stage of the race, and as you say, for it to be essentially tied?
Yeah, he has surprised me in two ways. You know, I said to you a year ago, both parties currently have nominees that are very unpopular, and one of the parties, if they change their nominee, they may win. And it may just be as simple as that. She may win because she's not Donald Trump. On the other hand, Trump, for the third consecutive presidential election, displays real power among these voters, especially voters without a college education, and male voters. He's getting a historic number of young male voters that traditionally are Democrats. So I think he's displayed more strength than Democrats gave him credit for. On the other hand, in 2016 and 2020, when he was involved in those close elections, he closed really, really well. He stayed on message more than he usually does. He had a closing argument. You're on the ground in North Carolina. No one, not even the Republicans, can say he's on message at the end. He's saying some crazy stuff. If he ends up losing, it'll be because he didn't close in the way he did in 2016 and 2020.
Jim Messina, thank you very much for talking to us.
Well, in the last few days, Donald Trump has again talked about election fraud. He said the military could be used against radical left lunatics. And Justin also spoke to Matt Schlapp, chairman of the right-wing American Conservative Union and former political director to President George W. Bush, about whether those sorts of words are driving some people away.
Nobody believes that Donald Trump was calling for Liz Cheney to be shot. What he was saying is that she's putting all of our sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters in harm's way in these conflicts. And how would she like it if she was actually putting herself or her loved ones in harm's way? As far as the media is concerned, they've been so despicable in this country for the last decade. They've been weaponized. They've picked sides politically. I'm sure that you don't have this in your home country, but our media is basically trying everything they can to make Kamala Harris win. And that's a breach of trust with the American people. You got to have journalism where you know where the truth is and where you can go to get unbiased facts. And we've lost that in America, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
Do you have a sense in the final hours of the campaign that you've got the ground game that can get your people to the polls?
No, I'm not, sadly. I think the Democrats still have a much better ground game than we do. Theirs is based on labor unions, environmental groups, abortion advocacy groups. It's very well funded by Arabella and other nonprofit networks and billionaires like George Soros and Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and others. And our side is, you know, predominantly local grassroots activists, a lot of people who are associated with the group that I chair, CPAC. We don't come even close. I would say not even 10% of the funding. And so it's one of the deficits you have when you run like Donald Trump is running. You have the social media oligarchs against you. You have the media against you. You have these well-funded NGOs and nonprofits against you. He's going to buck it all. He's going to win. But the money is a huge problem in American politics. It's all on the left.
And if he doesn't win, will he accept the result?
Well, I think that's a great question for Kamala Harris. Hillary Clinton didn't accept the results, and then Donald Trump didn't accept the results. But, of course, the media only wanted to talk about how Donald Trump didn't accept the results. Hillary Clinton made up this fantastical idea that Vladimir Putin had intervened to elect Donald Trump. And so we'll see what happens. But I think the real question is, if Donald Trump is winning in these states as he is in the polls going into it, which he's never been up in these states in these polls going into a presidential election, he's actually up in most of the key states, will the Democrats concede? Will Kamala Harris concede? Here's what I say. If it looks clear to me that Kamala Harris won, she'll be my president. If it looks clear to me that they've engaged in a bunch of illegal activities, I'll fight it like hell. And that's the way it should be in a free society.
Fight it like hell through the courts or on the streets?
Well, I'm not a violent person. The violence that we've seen in this country has come from the left. BLM did more destructive burning of buildings and destruction of property and harming police. Our own president had to be taken into the bunker in the White House than anything we've ever seen. So I like to engage in rhetoric, but I will take to the streets to defend my country if that means observing ballot boxes, if that means protesting. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I think we should keep it nonviolent.
Matt Schlapp, thank you very much for talking to us.
It is coming up to 10 to 9, a series of three programmes on Radio 4 exploring experiences of menopause begins today with a story of early menopause, which is usually understood as when it affects women under the age of 40. The average age for the menopause is 51, but it can happen much, much earlier than 40. And Annabel Gauntlet joins us. She will be presenting My Menopause at 15 as part of the series, and her programme is at 11 o'clock this morning on Radio 4. Good morning, Annabel.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. It is a really devastating story, yours. I think it began even earlier than 15 in your case.
Yes, I started having hot flushes when I was around 13. Severe anxiety, insomnia, cognitive issues. Yeah, it started really early.
But how did you connect it to something like menopause, which is decades away from the life of a 13-year-old, or should be decades away?
To be honest, I never connected the dots. I saw my mum go through menopause, but I never thought that I would be going through something like that. It wasn't until my teacher saw that I was having a hot flush and my face going bright red. And I knew it was a hot flush because I saw my mum having them. But it wasn't until that point that I thought that I might be going through that, because she said, I get those because I'm going through menopause.
So it meant that your periods started and stopped almost immediately?
Yes, well, I had my periods from a really early age, from when I was about 10 years old. And I had them, obviously, for about 3 years. And then they automatically stopped pretty much when I was 13. And I never had a period since.
And do you know why this happened to you? What is the cause of it?
No, it's a really tricky one. 90% of women who have POI, or early menopause,
POI standing for primary ovarian insufficiency.
Yes, yes. They don't have any answer as to why they've been diagnosed with it so soon, because obviously the natural age is around 55. But obviously that's not the case in terms of those numbers just keep going up. And that might be because more research is coming out about it. But obviously we don't know what's causing it.
You're still in your early 20s, I think. Is that right?
Yes, I'm 21.
And so how have you coped psychologically? What has it meant for the way that you think about the rest of your life, and including having a family?
I think the family part of it and fertility has been a bitter pill to swallow, I think, as I've gotten older. When I first was diagnosed, I didn't really comprehend what I was going through. I remember being in the doctor's room and my mum sitting there kind of shaking her head in her hands, crying. And I was there kind of nodding unknowingly what menopause was or what it was going to entail for my future. So there was that lack of understanding, I think, and that became a real issue as we went on.
And so how are you now? How do you think about it now?
I think as I've kind of settled down and got a partner and a career, and I think about it a lot more. And I think it's that feeling of there's a pass criteria to have a child. That's the way that I kind of see it. You see, you know, my friends settle down, have a child, and it seems so easy. And then you see the adoption process or getting a donor egg or IVF, and it just seems so daunting. You know, you don't really know how to even tackle it. That's how it feels in my eyes.
And of course, at your age, you shouldn't really be having to think about any of these things. You should be in the time when you still feel there's plenty of time to really think about that stage of life. But you're having to confront it all and to confront what looks unlikely to be possible.
Yeah, I think there's that feeling of it being a burden to whatever you put it on someone, if that makes sense. You know, I feel like when I was trying to date, I didn't know how to bring it up. I think my partner found out in a newsletter or in the paper. You know, I don't know how to tell people so much about it, because I feel like there's always been that stigma surrounding it. And it does kind of feel like it's falling on top of people and you don't want to speak about it because it's kind of that taboo.
Thank you so much, Annabelle, for being so honest. These are incredibly personal and difficult things to talk about. But you've talked to us and you're making the programme that'll be on Radio 4 at 11 this morning. Thank you.
Coming up just before we talk about Quincy Jones, let me tell you what's coming up after the news at 9 here on Radio 4. It is Start of the Week. You're hearing about that from Adam Rutherford. And if you want something completely different, a brand new music stream starts today. It's called Radio 3 Unwind. It's designed to bring you a distinctive range of classical music that helps us all escape the pressures and stresses of daily life. So go to BBC Sounds, tap on Radio 3 Unwind, or use your smart speaker and say, play Radio 3 Unwind. Well, let's stick with the thought about music at 5 to 9. And Quincy Delight Jones Jr., who's died at the age of 91, a jazz musician, a composer, arranger, entrepreneur, one of the greatest music producers who ever lived. Over the decades, he has produced some of the great albums, Michael Jackson's Thriller and Frank Sinatra's final solo studio album, the first time he recorded Mac the Knife. But with Quincy, big band. there we are with Quincy's big band right behind me. He started playing the piano at the age of 11 and then took up the trumpet from the age of 18 and went on to have his own TV production company, made Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down, and I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air.
Well, listening to that, Jamie Cullum, singer, songwriter, not too bad himself, in truth, and presents the jazz show on Radio 2, Jamie Hello. Do you think that's hyperbole, or is it right to describe Quincy Jones as one of the greatest ever?
It's absolutely correct. You know, this is someone who draws a through line through the greatest parts of the modern history of music, you know, as you've mentioned, right back to, you know, this guy kind of has connections and musical connections with Ray Charles, with Louis Armstrong, the Count Basie Orchestra, and then you take that right up to Frank Sinatra and then Michael Jackson, and then the new artists he's mentored in even just the last kind of 10 years, people like Jacob Collier, you know, part of his management company. And he did this all with not only the most charisma I've ever been in the presence of, I've had the chance to hang out with him and work with him a couple of times, but also kindness and expertise, and you know, real genuine expertise for arranging, for understanding what music could sound like, pushing boundaries. It's very hard to kind of compare someone who achieved all this in his life creatively.
And by the sound of it, over the decades, never lost that passion, that appetite for music and for working with new talent.
Absolutely. I really genuinely saw that firsthand. He was a regular guest at the Montreux Jazz Festival, which I've played at many times. And every time I went there, every year, he'd be sitting side stage, kind of offering people food and drink and listening to all the new musicians, you know, not just the big headline acts, but he was side stage for my show, for so many of the different people that were there. I saw him at the BBC Jazz Awards, and hanging out with all the young jazz musicians, like wanting to talk to them, wanting to understand what they were doing. This was someone who was interested in creativity and in passion and enthusiasm for creativity and music. And it was completely authentic and it was a joy to be around. What a legend.
What a fabulous story as well. I only just learned this. I don't know if you know it, Jamie, that in poverty, he broke into a recreation centre at the age of 11, fed himself on pie and ice cream, which was there because he was hungry, and found a piano. And that was it. That was the moment he discovered music.
Yes, I think it is a story. I know kind of a version of that story. I had the great pleasure of interviewing him in his house many years ago for Radio 2. And I think he is someone who feels the joy of being alive. And I think whatever kind of period of his life he has been in, whatever he has faced, I think that kind of joy, that innate sense of joy has kind of carried him through. But I think it's also that insane amount of talent and grit and determination that manages to not kind of anger people around him. People just really loved him as well. And I think it's quite hard when you get to that level to have such a great sense of love around you from everyone. I never met anyone who said a bad word about him.
I'm sure Radio 2 will produce tribute programmes to him in the days to come. Just in the last few seconds, Jamie, if you had to recommend something for people to listen to today to capture the genius of Quincy Jones, what would it be?
Well, you know, I'm going to just talk personally. There's a couple of albums he arranged for the Count Basie Orchestra, which are for me the sign of what a genius arranger he was. So many different things he did, but his arrangements with the Count Basie Orchestra are about as good as big band arranging can be.
That is what we'll turn to today. Jamie Cullum, thank you very much indeed for remembering the life of Quincy.